Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of the Jack Demmer Automotive Group inviting you into the Demmer family. With over 50 years of service in Metro Detroit, the team at Jack Demmer has everything to suit your needs. Whether it's a new or pre-owned vehicle, service, or even body repairs, Jack Demmer is your one-stop shop for all your automotive needs. Click on to Demmer.com today.
The Riff's Phone and Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much. Peter Werby is on vacation tonight. I'm Julian Jordan, his producer, and happy to be sitting in and being your host, your fill-in host this week. Thanks to Peter for giving me the microphone and giving me the chance to talk to you Riff listeners. And to those of you around the world listening at www.wrif.com, welcome to you, because I know it is an international show. We have listeners all over the United States, all over the world, and right here at home in Detroit, Michigan. 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743 if you want to dial in. And I'm going to make the show pretty phone call heavy. I know Peter tends to talk a little more, and I'm going to try to talk a little less, give you the information, and then you can respond. As always, what I prefer is that you kind of guide the show. Whatever topic is close to your heart, I'll throw some out. And if there's anything new that I'm not touching on that you would like to touch on, well, hey, go for it. Also, if you would like to email, I'll be checking our email throughout the show and reading those. It's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And don't forget Peter Werby's website. That's peterwerby.com. W-E-R-B-E is how you spell his last name. We also have a MySpace now. Nightcall, myspace.com/nightcalldetroit. So if you would like to be one of our friends, we'd like to have you. You can give your comments. You can email, even though for some reason, I'm having some MySpace issues, and I'm unable to write anything back. But we do read each and every one of your emails. The best way for us to respond to you is to simply email us at the calltalkyes@yahoo.com address. All right. Well, let's get started. It looks like many Republicans continuing to abandon their president. And Bush, this last week, saying he needs public support. Well, the numbers are down, folks, and the numbers are very telling as to what's going on out there. Only 28% of Americans are still with G.W. Bush. A 28% approval rating, or as we like to say, a 72% disapproval rating. It's pretty pathetic. And if you read one thing throughout the week, you know, there's a lot of information out there, and if you think you can get all of your information by watching CNN or, you know, God forbid, Fox News, you're not going to be able to get all the information to make a really critical decision about these things that are going on in the world. And there is so much. But I would recommend to you from the New York Times, Frank Rich, his op-ed every Sunday is absolutely astounding and dead on. I want to start the show by going through a list of the corruption, the incompetence, the contracting and cronyism scandals in the Bush administration. Frank Rich, in his column, Earth to GOP, The Gipper is Dead, is just amazing. You must read it. But I'm going to give you part of it. This is Frank Rich's rough conservative, I like how he throws that in there, calculation. He's saying, he's not even saying everything that is wrong. So feel free to add, okay? Feel free to add at 313-298-WRIF. This is the list. There has been corruption, incompetence, contracting, or cronyism scandals in these cabinet departments. The Defense Department, Education, Justice, Interior, Homeland Security, Veterans Affairs, Health and Human Services, and Housing and Urban Development. Now, he's not counting State, whose Deputy Secretary, a champion of abstinence-based international AIDS funding, resigned last month in that old prostitution scandal. You've heard that here on this program. Or how about the General Services Administration, now being investigated for possibly steering federal favors to Republican congressional candidates in 2006? Or how about the Office of Management and Budget, whose chief procurement officer was sentenced to prison in the Abramoff fallout? And this is what we would say an all-time record, an all-time record. What do you think about that? Does this make you feel good, Republicans? I would like to know, for the 28% of you who still report, who still are for what's going on in this administration, who still support this administration, what is it that keeps you supporting them? Because I can't figure out anything. I never have from the beginning. But now, really, after all these years, what is it you're supporting? I mean, it is just, they're a pack of psychos in my personal opinion. Do you remember when George Bush called himself a different kind of Republican, a compassionate conservative? And you know Karl Rove, Bush's brain, if any of you haven't read that or seen that, I highly recommend that. Karl Rove wanted to build a lasting Republican majority by emulating the tactics of 1896 candidate William McKinley. His victory ushered in GOP dominance that would last until the New Deal some 35 years later. I think that's frightening. And when we went into Iraq and invaded that country, we said that back then, Peter and I, here on this program and another syndicated program that we used to host together, that it is going to take decades, decades to fix what this administration has messed up for the United States and for the world as a whole. Well, I say, as I said, I want to make this show very much about you. And I am going to now attempt the phone system for the first time. It's a different one than when we rock here. This is when we talk. Okay, here we go. We have on line one, Rashid from Whitmore Lake wants to talk about Bush. Welcome to Night Call, Rashid. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you so much. I love listening to the riff at all times when I'm going to work or going to school. As you guys just making my day.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate that.
I'm just sick and tired of hearing all the lies that Bush has been saying about the schools being improved and everything overseas is being improved. My family is from Beirut, Lebanon, and with all the bombings and everything that's going on in Beirut right now, it shouldn't be Bush's responsibility to go in there and take care of everything. Because it's a civil war that's going on
right
in Beirut. And all the lies that he's been giving he's not been making anything a main focus but what he wants to improve, not what needs to be improved.
What do you think he wants to improve?
I think he just wants to improve, you know, democracy in every single country. He thinks that if something goes wrong in another country, that we have to go over there and fix it,
right,
which shouldn't be, you know, because there's a lot of things that are going on in the United States that should be, you know, our attention.
We should attend to, yes.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, if we really want to go after the big name like terrorists and, you know, dictators, why don't we go to South Korea or why don't we go to Africa or, you know, then fix them problems.
Well, yeah, that's a great point. If we're going to start democratizing these dictatorships around the world, why aren't we in Saudi Arabia, which is where all of those men on the planes on 9/11 were from?
Exactly. But, I mean, they're not actually from those, you know, like, those countries and everything. They were a group of people that came together to make a statement. Now, those statements were not right, and Bush wants to fight against terrorism, but, I mean, terrorism is going to be everywhere, wherever you go. I mean, we even had a terrorist in our that came from our own state, Timothy McVeigh.
Yeah, right.
I mean, and he killed innocent people just for a governmental cause.
And that was an American terrorist.
That's a terrorist attack.
Yeah.
Terrorism is going to be wherever it wants to be.
Yeah.
There's no stopping to it. Now, to make other countries to live like we do, that's wrong. I mean, yes, taking Saddam out of power was probably a good thing, but he also kept control. He did some bad things, yes. He killed people, he tortured people, but he was no threat to the United States at all.
You know, the thing that always blows me away is that we forget that back in the 80s that we were friends with Saddam Hussein. If you look back, you can see all the photos of Rumsfeld shaking his hand, and we gave them all kinds of chemicals that they could use for weapons. So first, this is my analogy of what the United States does, especially in a Bush administration. First, we love you. Then we hate you. Then we'll get you. This doesn't seem like democracy to me.
Exactly. And also, the thing that people don't notice about that the Osama bin Laden family and the Bush family have been friends for over the years.
That's right. And in fact, you remember on 9/11 that day or the next day, it was within 24 hours, all of the bin Ladens were actually flown out of the United States by our government on our dollar. It's insanity. It's complete insanity, and it continues.
It just doesn't make sense. I mean, Bush is going to ruin, like, the voting for everybody, Republican and Democratic. Like, people are not want to vote because they don't want another mistake to happen.
Well, I think everyone should continue to vote, in my opinion.
That's the power we have, right? That's our right. I mean, that's our right. Some countries don't even have the right to vote.
Yeah, that's true.
I just don't know what to say.
How about the fact that only 30-some percent of the Americans go out and actually vote? When you look at France, and 85% vote. Something's wrong with this picture. This country is just a mess.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you, Rashid. We appreciate you calling in.
No problem. Thank you.
Have a great night.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye. And Rashid took advantage of 313-298-WRIF. We appreciate him calling in. And let's go to Ferndale. We have Al on the phone. You can tell I'm trying to click it on. This is the Drew and Mike phone system. So now I know how to run their show. Right. Al's calling from Ferndale. Hi, Al. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Julian. How are you tonight?
I'm doing fine.
Why?
What's
sound like you guys got something going here. You know what? You got a couple more years before this man is out of office, right?
Right.
So hopefully maybe, which you see it, I see it, and probably everybody in this United States sees it, that he ain't going to do much to taking care of business over there. He needs to pull us out of there before he leaves, for one.
How soon do you think we should get out of there?
Yeah, oh, without a doubt. Two, I heard this rumor, me being a vet, a Vietnam vet on top.
You're in Vietnam, okay.
Yes, ma'am. And I think that what I've heard is that, cause I don't know, for ungodly reason, that Bush wants to cut back on the VA benefits for us veterans that went and served our country so everybody can live freedom in this country. And I don't know how true it is, but I don't think that that's the way to go on pulling money from the veterans that have fought for our country and lost their lives to make this country as free as it can be. And it's just going to hurt a lot of people, going to hurt a lot of vets. Wrong way to go about it. I don't know what's going on with him anymore. And what, he got a couple more years in office with him, so.
Too long, that's for sure.
That's the problem, too many years. And what the heck are we going to do, Jaleen?
Well, I think it's very telling that you are a Vietnam vet, and you were over there, and you were in it, right?
Yes.
You were in it, as if you know what I mean. And do you feel that your country has respected you and taken care of you all these years since you've come home?
No, because I had to fight for almost close to 30 years just to get the benefits that I deserve and that I need, because I'm on a disability. And, you know, the numbers that I get for disability per month is only a three-digit. And, you know, that's not much for somebody that went and did what I had to do at 18 years old to come out here and survive and then got treated like I did. And I'm still fighting for it. I'm, you know, and that's just something I got to live with for the rest of my life and never goes away. And my government, your government, our government, I don't really see too highly of her, you know, and I haven't ever since I was put into Vietnam when I was 18, man. And it's just, I get a different perspective on a lot of different things out there, and I just live day by day. But it's just sad for the economy now, on what we have to go through, what the younger people, what the kids have got to go through nowadays to grow up to make something in society. And, you know, like with the schools, you know, so much money is supposed to go to the school. Why are they shutting all these schools down and stuff, you know? I mean, where are these kids going to get their education?
Yeah, it's a sad state of affairs, that is for sure. Well, Al, thank you very much for calling. 313-298-WRIF. We appreciate you, and we appreciate what you've done for our country.
Thank you, Darren. Have a wonderful evening.
Okay, I'll talk to you very soon.
And God bless America.
Thank you, Al.
Have a good night.
All right, Al calling in from Ferndale. And there is a perfect example, a Vietnam vet who feels that this war is absolutely wrong, that we should be bringing these troops home. Now, I don't feel that I have all the answers. I don't feel that I know that right now bringing all the troops home is the thing. Should it be gradual? That's kind of where I stand a little bit of. But you know what? Now, it looks like the Iraqi parliament wants us out just as much as we, those who are against this occupation of Iraq, want them out, want our troops home and safe. And that is what also some of these Republicans are saying in Congress. What they're saying this past week to Bush, in case you didn't catch any of the coverage on that or read anything about it, is a bunch of Republicans got together with Bush and kind of came down on the guy. And they said, progress by September. Those are the three words. It's the latest mandate from what they call some nervous Republicans to President Bush, GW as I call him, over the war in Iraq, as the Democratic-controlled House passed yet another war spending bill last week, and Bush promised yet another veto. What a shock. Some members of his own party went to the White House with a blunt warning to Bush, saying, we're with you now, but if there is no progress by September, all bets are off. So now even his own party is against him. I think this is very telling. The only problem is nobody in Washington seems to agree on what progress actually means or how precisely it might be measured. So no one even knows what the hell it means. No one knows how to measure it. And then Dick Cheney goes to Iraq, a surprise trip. How he gets through that without the insurgents finding him, I don't know. He must have some serious, well, obviously, security. And they keep it quiet until he lands and la, la, la. Well, after this trip to Iraq, Cheney was asked by Fox News if he saw signs of decisive progress, quote unquote. He responded by talking about the Anbar province, where Sunni tribal sheikhs are turning against al-Qaeda. This is what he said. And George Bush, speaking to his party faithful last week in Washington, offered his own evidence that things are looking better. He is still trying to convince us that things are looking better. And this is now, from what I understand, the surge is all is there. They're all there. The five brigades of the troop buildup in place. GW says sectarian murders are down. Okay, think about this. Sectarian murders are down. Though he neglected to mention the fact that car bombings and deaths of American soldiers, are up. So sectarian murders are down, but there's more car bombings, and more of our men and women are dying. Is this okay with you? 313-298-WRIF. It's certainly not okay with me. Got another phone call to take. Let's go to Tim in Port Huron, and it looks like, Tim, you want to talk about the, are you an Iraq vet?
I am.
Okay.
Six months in Fallujah.
Okay.
Going into that war, I was completely behind George Bush because I thought it was the right thing at the time.
Yeah.
Now, you know, serving 6 months over there, serving this, you know, seeing what went on over there, I totally do not back what George Bush is doing right now. He is holding our troops over there right now hostage to his own ego.
Ah, well, hey. This is very interesting because we get one or the other, you know, when we talk to the men and women who have been over there. And you saw it firsthand. Can you tell us, were there a lot of other men and women around you who secretly felt this way but didn't feel that they could speak out for fear of retaliation from their own or, you know, from their commanders?
You know, I think it's 50-50, actually, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And it's growing. It's swaying towards more of the rebelling against the commander in chief, pretty much. And you know, I saw some things that I don't care to see again in my life. And I'm glad I served my country well, and I'm proud of that, doing that. But I'm not gonna lie to you. I won't do it again.
Okay. Now you went. When were you there, Tim?
I was there in 2004.
Okay, and you did 6 months, and you haven't had to go back?
I did not have to go back. I got out, went to school.
Okay. That's really surprising because I'm hearing about these two tour, three tour, four tours. Is it a choice that you said you're not going back? Or
no, it's I was in the reserves, so it, you know,
right.
My troop never went back. And they actually did go back when I was gone. So.
Oh, okay. Well, boy, this is very telling, and I sure appreciate you calling in and sharing your feelings on that. And so, would you have considered yourself a Republican before you?
I did consider myself a Republican. In the 2006 election, I voted straight Democratic for the first time in my life.
Oh, okay. Because you had already been there, and you'd already
seen
enough.
What happened. I seen enough, and I won. I mean, if these Republicans are gonna, you know, go down on George Bush, I have complete support of that because, you know, John McCain is supposedly the guy that's going to, you know, he ran, you know, he's in the war, blah, blah, blah. He's too wishy-washy on subjects, and
yeah.
I don't see how he can do things better than, you know, sure, I don't like Hillary Clinton, you know, but she can do a better job than John McCain. And,
I think so, too.
Right.
John McCain's lost his mind, Tim.
Yes, he's just, you know, John Kerry wasn't the best choice.
He was a better choice, though.
He was the lesser two evils.
Absolutely. And it's sad that that's the state of affairs. And as we look at the green parties and third parties and things like that, I personally just don't think we're ready for that. I'm ready for the day. I would give anything to not vote Democrat as a Democrat. And I'm an independent, but I vote Democrat because I see that that vote is going to mean more, not take away from other votes. And now this could start a whole nother conversation, and I'm fine with that because that's the way this show goes. Tim, thank you very much for calling from Port Huron tonight.
Thank you.
And, hey, we're glad you're safe, and we're glad you're home.
I'm glad myself.
All right. Take care. Hang in there. And alrighty. Stay on the right side of things, which means
I will
left. Okay. All right, Tim. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to Ken in Walt Lake. He's standing by on the Riff Lines. And, Ken, thanks for calling Night Call tonight. How are you?
Good.
Good. Good to talk to you. What's on your mind? You know what? Can you turn your radio down really quick?
Yep.
It's that whole feedback thing, you know? Ooh. Okay.
Is that better?
Did you turn it off? Yeah, there we go. You sound great.
All right.
Go ahead.
Who am I talking to?
Oh, who are you talking to?
Yeah.
This is the Night Call program. It's Peter Werby, usually. I'm Julian Jordan, his producer. I'm filling in for Peter. He took a vacation. Good for him, huh?
Yeah.
Right on. What's on your mind?
I don't know.
You want to talk about Bush? You want to talk about the war? You want to talk,
The war kind of went bad, you know.
It went horribly bad.
Yeah, I think he made a big mistake going in there.
Yeah.
I mean, I voted for Bush.
Both times?
Yeah.
Shame on you. Shame on you, Ken.
After 9/11, I mean, after we got all them people killed when they flew them planes in.
But let me ask you this, Ken. You understand that those were not Iraqis who did that, right?
Yeah, no.
Okay. So to equate the two to go into Iraq because of 9/11 is simply wrong.
Well, Iraq was something different. We were still kind of at war with them.
Well, what we were doing was putting sanctions on them after the first time we went in Desert Storm. And a result of those sanctions were 1 million men, women, and mostly women and children died because we weren't giving them the necessities that they needed. We sanctioned them. They couldn't even get toothbrushes.
Well, I kind of like to see Saddam Hussein out of there.
Well, he's out of there.
But, you know, he was hard-fisted, and he took the country under control.
But let me ask you why it was our responsibility. You know, why was it our responsibility? Who made us the bullies of the world? Do you know what I'm saying, Ken?
I think it was after World War II.
Okay. But
everybody.
Okay, but in the 80s, I'll reiterate that there's photos. You can see them if you Google, I don't know if you're in the computer world, but you can see the photos of Donald Rumsfeld shaking the hand of Saddam Hussein. They were friends. We gave them. You would not believe how many chemicals we gave this guy.
Oh, yeah. We create our monsters.
Yes.
We have to take them out.
We created the monsters, so then we have to take them out. And that just is so backward-ass, as far as I'm concerned.
I know, but...
Yeah. Well, it's a real mess, and I'm hoping, Ken, that you don't vote that way again.
I have some cousins over there.
Do you?
Oh, and I don't want them to get killed.
No, you don't. How long have they been there?
He went over. He's been there a couple months now.
Okay. Does he email you? Do you communicate?
Well, I communicate with his dad. But
yeah. And I bet his dad doesn't sleep well at night.
Oh, he don't want to be there.
No.
Oh, let's just nuke him. That's his.
No, thing. God. That is absolutely what we do not want.
We do not want that. We got a mess over there.
Yeah.
And those people are crazy. I don't know.
Well, I think the people in the White House are the crazy ones, to be honest with you. And most of the people in Iraq are simply civilians like you and I. You know, you live in Walt Lake. It's just like all you and your neighbors. It's the same thing over there. They're not these wild-eyed crazy people. They're just people like you and I. The several hundred quote-unquote insurgents. Yeah, we're fighting like 400 men. That's what we're doing. And I think it's absolutely, I need to find more words, but insane is a perfect word for it, I should say. Ken, thank you so much for calling.
All right, thanks.
Okay, and you think, hopefully you can think long and hard before this next election, because if you looked at that Republican debate, those 13 white men in suits up there are really scary.
Well,
okay?
I think our world's gone crazy.
It has gone crazy. It has, absolutely. But it's up to people like you and I at a grassroots level to do what we can to make a difference. So if you find yourself frustrated, well, go to peterwerby.com and find out where Peter and I will be, because we're constantly out at rallies and protests and gatherings and things like that. And it really does help even your own sanity. I can attest to that. All right. Thank you, Ken.
All right. Bye.
Take care. Have a great night. Ken calling in from Walt Lake. And the phone lines are filling up, so this is wonderful. I'm glad you're calling tonight. 313-298-WRIF or 313-298-9743. If you're shy, you don't want to talk on the air, well, don't be afraid. Trust me, it's an easy thing to do. But you can email calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Okay, let's see who's been waiting the longest. We'll go to Ed in Belleville. Ed, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you this evening?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for calling Night Call with Peter Werby. I'm Julian Jordan. And what's on your mind tonight, Ed?
Wanted to call in and I guess throw my two cents in worth topic of discussion. And I am a honorably discharged vet. I served 86 to 90, you know, when all this stuff was really starting.
Oh, wow.
And it's you know, really a shame how downhill things have gotten. And, you know, comments that the previous caller had made about, you know, we need to get in there and take these people out. These monsters that we've created, why do we create them? You know, why not take it out that way?
Okay, you know? And the monsters, are you speaking of Bush?
You know, it is what it is, and I served under his father, and, you know, things weren't right then either, and it's just, you know, we need to get the big business Texans out of this office.
Amen.
And, you know, put an end to it. I mean, instead of, you know, worrying about what's going on over in Iraq, why not throw a little bit of that money, you know, towards Belleville, Michigan?
Thank you.
And help my economy out.
Absolutely. You know what, Ed? I'm going to put you on hold real quick. I'm going to come back to you. We need to take a quick break. Time has just flown by.
And
we can't forget that thing called commercial. So I'm going to put you on hold. We'll be back. So think about what how you'd like to wrap this up. We'll be back on Night Call on 101 WRIF.
This is WRIF.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, Peter Werby on vacation. I'm Julian Jordan, his producer, on-air producer, and I'm very happy to be sitting in for Peter tonight. I hope he has a wonderful vacation. He deserves it. I know he spends way too much time thinking about the Bush administration and obsessing, don't we all? We're going to go back to Ed on the phone line, 313-298-WRIF, by the way. We've been talking about what, guess what? Iraq. Go figure. Okay. Ed, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Did you have any final thoughts before I head on to some other phone calls?
I guess the only thing I really have to say is, you know, let's get these people, you know, our folks back safe and, you know, as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just can't come home tomorrow.
Right.
And I think we need to stop worrying so much about, you know, the weapons of mass destruction.
Because there weren't any, right.
Right. And, you know, all the other excuses that it's going to be. And put that money back into our people and into our economies and, you know, let's stop trying to support everybody else and support ourselves.
I think we definitely need a little more concentration here at home because we are suffering, especially here in Michigan, aren't we?
Oh, right. Absolutely. And I mean, job loss and all that. My wife lost her job after 20 years of service.
Oh, that's
you know, economic cutbacks. I lost my job to an injury last June. And, you know, it's money's running out. And it's like, you know, what are you going to have to do? You sell everything you own, have to sell your house if you're lucky.
Maybe move in with some family. I mean, I see this everywhere. I have a lot of friends who are facing the same situation, and it is really a sad state of affairs. So we can only look forward to a brighter day. Right, Ed?
Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you. You have a great evening and a great week, and good luck to you as you head into a very uncertain future, as many of us are. Okay, let's go to Bob in Milford, who's been waiting patiently on the lines. Bob? Hi, welcome to NICOL. Welcome.
Great, great. I want to say hi to you, Julie.
Hi.
And, you know, I want to, you know, give the props. I mean, I know we've been talking about the war in Iraq. Give props to the our fine service people over in Iraq.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, we're over there.
Yep.
Whether we like it or not, agree with it or whatever, we're there.
Yes, we are. We're in it.
And, you know, is the solution just to yank us out of there? Well, I don't know that I have that one.
I don't know that I do either.
And, you know, the thing is we need to support them. And, you know, we got our own problems here at home. And, you know what? Do we want to have, you know, more jobs in Southeast Michigan? Without a doubt. Do we want to be sending jobs other places? No way.
All right.
Can we solely blame that on what's going on in one other country? It's a very complex issue.
Sure is.
It really isn't just something that's got one solution.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Bob. And you know, like I was saying earlier, what is the answer? Personally, I think we should start now slowly getting them out of there. But we just did the surge. We just sent 30,000 more troops over there. And the fact is, it doesn't seem to be helping.
Well, I mean, I'm not there. I mean, I'll admit.
Yeah.
I'm not there. I don't know. I mean, you hear the stories of guys that are, have been over there, and you know they come into to these towns, and you know you hear the outpourings of children just coming out and cheering them. I mean, like you hear those great stories, and you're like, wow, how can we not be there?
Well, I think what you're hearing, you know, the mainstream media only shows the good stuff. We don't see the bodies coming back, right?
I'm not talking mainstream media. Okay. I know people who have been over there.
Yeah. Well, I would think that little kids would have hope for a brighter day.
I'm not a little kid, and I have hope for a brighter day.
Well, I'm glad that you do, because I don't see one in the short term. I don't see much of a brighter day. As I was saying at the beginning of the show, we're talking, I don't know, maybe a couple of generations until this mess is cleaned up. I think this has set a pattern for just devastation to continue for decades.
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about a pattern of devastation, I mean, we're looking at, I mean, the United States has been on that, on a path of devastation possibly for years. I mean, for generations of generations. I mean, you know, devastation, you want to look at, you know, how we haven't, you know, cleaned up our, you know, our environmental issues.
Yeah.
We just kind of, you know, a pattern of devastation. I mean, it's not just going to, I don't think it's going to come to a head just because we're, you know, in Iraq and trying to fight necessarily a war that, may or may not have a means to an end.
All right. Well, we'll just have to wait and see. It looks like a lot of people, even Bush's own people, are turning against him. Bob, thanks for calling in.
Well, thank you.
Did you want to say something else?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, it's your show.
Just wanted to give you a chance.
Not a problem.
All right. Thanks for calling in. We appreciate it. All right. Bob from Milford calling in to Night Call at 313-298-WRIF. And let's see who is next. We have Tim calling from Detroit. Let me hold on. This phone system. This is my first night using it. I'm actually kind of proud of how well I've done so far. I haven't hung up on anyone. Tim in Detroit, are you there? You want to talk about Condi?
I do want to talk about Condi.
What's up with Condi?
Well, you know, the 59th reason the Bush administration gave for going to Iraq was to stop the Oil for Food program, because we all knew those evil French, you know, those cheese-eating surrender monkeys. I mean, they were just
in
Iraq, you know, and they were just, you know, lied to the world, and the French sold weapons. Well, it turns out old Condoleezza Rice, who was right on the Chevron board.
Right.
You know, Chevron is a big oil company.
She sure was, wasn't she? Gosh, thanks for the reminder.
Chevron was also involved in the Oil for Food program, and guess who knew about it? Condoleezza Rice. Last week, Exxon ended up paying a $25 million fine for kickbacks to Saddam Hussein in the tens of millions of dollars.
Oh, gosh.
I knew about a chapter and verse, and I call for impeachment.
Oh, I call for impeachment, too. In fact, I'm seeing more and more of those signs, those yard signs. I think people are really just fed up, like you.
You believe these people? I mean, one after another, you got Gonzalez, he's putting in his boys with Karl Rove so they can steal the black vote. You know, you've got people at the GSA stealing money for defense contractors. You got Rumsfeld, you know, I mean, sizing down the military when he knew very well we were going to have at least a two-front war.
Yeah.
And then he let the North Koreans go with their nukes. You know, Clinton shut that down. And you still got idiots out there supporting Bush. I don't get it.
Yeah, the 28%. That's what I keep saying. Who are you and why are you still supporting this president? My next door neighbor, who they actually are very nice people, and who knows, they may be listening. I told them that they shouldn't, so we can remain friends. You know, it's the neighbor thing. But they still support this guy, and I don't want to get into it with my neighbors, but I do wonder why. Why in the hell? How in the hell can you support this administration at this point? I want to know why.
What I tell people is, okay, don't watch Fox News. I mean,
oh.
it's a propaganda station. I mean, it's gotten a lot of money from the Republican Party. It's getting back to the RNC. You know, Bill O'Reilly, he's a party hack.
You know what, Tim? I just read today that, the Republican debates that were, I think it was last week or the week before.
Yeah.
Time flies in this crazy world. But, that Fox News, that Bill O'Reilly got higher ratings than that MSNBC debate with the Republicans. Bill O'Reilly, even the Republicans didn't watch the Republican debates. And when you saw those pack of 13 psychotic men up there, you can see why.
Well, you've got McCain. I mean, he's singing a Beach Boys song and twisting that. Then you've got God, if you have his mind. You know?
I missed the Beach Boys song.
You know, it's Barbara Ann. It's an old 60s song.
Yeah, I remember the song.
You know, he was going bomb, 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 Iran and all that. And he tried to make a joke out of it.
Really?
Yeah,
oh, that's repulsive.
I think you have another guy. He wants to deport all the Mexicans, if that's possible anyway.
Did you read how much Mitt Romney is worth? Gosh, I wish I could find that right now.
I don't know, about 50 or 60 million or
something. No, it's like, it's hundreds of millions.
Now, was he for abortion before he was against it? How does that work with
him? He was, I believe he was pro-choice, yeah, for a long time. But in the last, maybe 5+ years, Mitt Romney has changed his position on abortion. And then we have Rudy Giuliani. Giuliani, who's Mr. Flip-flop number two behind John McCain, well, maybe three, and Mitt Romney. I mean, these guys are out of control.
Do you know, I think a lot of people may not know that he actually ended up putting a lot of fuel at Tower 7 in the World Trade Center complex. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of conspiracy theorists think, well, you know, the buildings went up so high because there were actually, you know, demolitions in there. But probably what happened was when the planes hit those buildings, there was so much, fuel oil in the buildings that actually ignited the explosion further.
Right.
So that probably can explain, you know, why the buildings went up at such an incredible rate. You know, it wasn't so much that they put explosives in there, but Giuliani, by his stupidity, put in that whole, fuel oil in the Trade Center Tower.
Oh, that's amazing. And you know, Giuliani, I mean, this guy, just because he was the sitting, you know, the mayor at the time, doesn't mean that he fixed all of this. He did a good job of calming the public down by going in front of TV cameras. And he, you know, I'm not sure that anyone who would be in that position would do the same thing, don't you think?
Well, he made things worse. Okay, there was like a command structure that he had with, I think it was his lieutenant and his fire chief, and he deliberately split them apart. And they told him, look, we've got to coordinate. We've got to, you know, we've got to get our walkie-talkies on the same frequency as our other communication systems. And he would refuse to do that.
Hmm.
And as a result, a lot of firefighters went back in and ended up dying because of that. I mean, there was no lack of communication.
Yeah.
The thing with Giuliani was it was a complete snow job, you know, for the public. Well, he's really doing the job, but he really wasn't. And as a result, I mean, like a lot of families now are really angry with his job over there. He's a terrible mayor, and he might even be more dangerous than Bush if he's elected.
Yeah, scary to think about that. I don't know. I didn't think anyone could be.
Yeah, it's possible. There's some nutballs out there.
Yeah, there are. There's
plenty.
The thing
plenty. Is with Roe, with these attorneys real quick, is that if these attorneys are allowed to stand, what they might do is they might cage a lot of the voters. What that means is that, for example, let's say if you're a member of the poor community or if you're a minority, you get a ballot, they're not going to necessarily count that. And the thing is, I mean, since our public now is fairly, you know, there might be more Democrat supporters now. It's hard to say, but I mean, it's still fairly even. So if enough people are taken off of voter rolls, you're still going to have another rigged election.
Right.
And our country can't afford it. I mean, we have a $10 trillion debt. Our budget deficits are huge. I mean, our dollar, if you've seen overseas, our dollar is like worth 1 to 1.35 in the European market.
Well, how shocking. Wait, what do you mean? The land of opportunity? The wealthiest country in the world?
Well, so the wealthiest for the top 1%. The rest of us are scraping by, you know?
That's right. We are scraping by. I can attest to that. Tim in Detroit, thank you so much for calling tonight.
Sure.
Have a great night, and thanks for calling Night Call, 313-298-WRIF, as we head over to Inkster, and Al is waiting on the line. Thanks for calling Night Call, Al. What's on your mind?
Hi, Julie.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing fabulous, thank you. How about you?
Oh, I'm doing fabulous. I'm just sitting here thinking about all the overpaid auto workers out there.
What? Ooh, you're really going to get things going now, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they make incredible amounts of money without doing a whole lot of what they're supposed to do. Specifically of Alan Mulally, whose take-home pay is $544,000 a week.
Now you're talking. I thought
doesn't have to pay for his transportation, doesn't have to pay for his rent because those are picked up as perks.
Right.
And I think how many auto workers could keep their jobs if he just, say, cut his salary down to a reasonable, say, $54,000.
Hey, you know, I didn't know where you were going with this, but I like where you've ended up. I think you make a good point.
Well, I was going where I wanted to go, which is, yeah, there are overpriced auto workers out there. I read the letters to the paper all the time about how they're driving the auto industry into the ground. And, well, hey, I found an overpriced auto worker who's driving the industry into the ground.
Hey, there you go. It's him. It's Mulally. Now, did you read anything or watch any of the coverage about Barack Obama? He came to town and kind of took the auto industry here in Detroit to task, didn't he?
Yes, he did, and I mean, I semi-agree with what he said, because, I mean, the auto industry years ago should have been working on alternative fuels and different types of power.
Right, and the foreign auto companies have been doing this for a long time. I personally believe it is time for that to happen. We've got to do something about these carbon emissions.
If they can make an economically fuel-efficient car that the market buys, why can't we?
Yeah, and they'll buy them like crazy. That's the thing. I mean, the next vehicle I buy will be something that's more fuel efficient. I wish I could be like Willie Nelson and have, you know, one of those vehicles where you put the oil from the fast food restaurants to fuel it?
Yeah, and you're driving along getting stoned going, you know, I'm really hungry for some french fries. Oh, no, that's the Dearborn Police. My bad.
Well, we all know Willie likes his weed. It's all right.
Yeah, he got pulled over. It was news. He got pulled over and arrested for marijuana. I was like, no, news would have been if he'd gotten pulled over and not had marijuana.
Isn't that the truth? Okay, Al. Hey, thanks for calling in tonight. Call tonight. We appreciate your input.
All right, bye.
Have a good one. Bye. Willie Nelson. And let's see. We'll go to, we have a call from Flint. Kelly from Flint calling in, been holding on patiently. Thank you for holding, Kelly. And what's on your mind tonight?
Hi, I'm Kelly.
Hi, Kelly.
How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Actually, I'm driving home, and I heard you speaking your show for the first time.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I do have a station that goes all the way up to Flint to listen to you again. I hope I do. I'm visiting a friend down the metro area, so I'm on my way, and I thought, let me listen to this station, and I liked what I heard.
Well,
I
usually we rock. It's a rock station, you know, and for 37 years. But this show, Night Call, has been on the air for 37 years with Peter Werby, and I'm his producer. I'm filling in, and you can also listen at WRIF.com. So if you're in Flint and you can't hear us, you can listen to us online. And there's also podcasts. You can listen to these shows anytime during the week, just so you know. But go ahead. What's
Sounds
on your mind?
Good. I do agree with the impeachment of George War Weapons Bush.
Ooh.
I do definitely agree with his impeachment. He's destroyed a beautiful country for his oil-dwelling ideas. There was no reason for it. Pretty much he used the troops as blood weapons. He's killed numerous people for no apparent reason but his own. He's destroyed a beautiful country. Like, I am a history major. I do know of the surrounding areas of the Middle East, and it was once a beautiful country.
Beautiful.
And yes, and there was no reason for his war, so-called war. It was not a war, it was an invasion. He pretty much brainwashed the whole country of the United States to think it was some sort of weapons of mass destruction, just like you said earlier on regards to Hussein. He was trained here in the United States.
Yeah.
He was trained by his administration, well, his father's administration, and there is a path between them. And if this country woke up and stood up and realized the facts instead of listening to Fox News, which is right-winged and paid by his administration to say what they want to say,
mm-hmm.
we wouldn't be in this predicament. But because everybody is so brainwashed into this and they don't go into their own facts, now we are suffering not only economically, but emotionally. I mean, these troops are coming in to this United States and popping depressant pills just to stay alive because of the things that they have seen over there. Now, they think Vietnam was war. This is no Vietnam. And I just wanted to say it's quite sad, and it's just unbelievable. People should know the truth. I do want to say there is a website. I'm not promoting it or anything, but it is a movie. You just go to Google. It's called Loose Change. You just go to Google. You put Loose Change, the movie, and it does state facts of George W. Bush and Saddam Hussein's butt buddies. So, I mean, these people, these people think that, you know, he was this dictator. Well, hey, the dictator that's dictating us taught him. So that's what I have to say.
That's right.
And that country had nothing to do with us. Nothing at all. Like I said, he was filling his oil dwelling pockets on the blood of our troops.
Absolutely.
For no apparent reason.
That's right. And it's criminal. It's absolutely criminal.
It's criminal, and everyone is going about with their business, driving. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm driving their Mercedes-Benz and just having a la-la time every single day of their lives. And it's pretty sad because it will catch up to us.
Kelly, question for you. Don't you think that so many people have just become simply immune to all of this?
Oh, yeah. Immune and lazy.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not in the error of my parents, but I do, like I said, I'm a history major. There were people that had dignity, respect, and morals, and they stood up to what is right. These days, if they say something, people just nod their head and go along with it. What happened to your dignity? What happened to your pride that you once had 15 years ago? You let the George W. Bush administration take over it? America was America, and it was a strong America, was based on belief and faith, and they helped each other. They did not just, I mean, it's just unbelievably a big mess, and unless somebody decides to speak up against this administration. I'm not talking, did you see the Mexicans out in their rallies? They stood up. I'm not going to say that I'm for them or against them.
Okay.
I do know that they did help this country rise. I'm not going to say that everyone, America is a melting pot and there's all kinds of foreigners. They did help this country rise.
The land of opportunity, Kelly. That's what we taunt all over the world. So when they want to come here, why wouldn't they?
Exactly. Just like you came, or your ancestors came, and my ancestors came.
Right.
They came too. And like I said, they built this country. I'm not going to say all of it, but they had a nice chunk of it. I mean, they helped. I just passed right now through the construction and seen probably about 30 of them, and they were all Mexican. And I know they're not getting paid as much as, you know, as regular people do, but hey, they're out there doing it, and they're ones complaining. But then, yet they're complaining because they want to become U.S. citizens. They're not complaining because they need money. They're complaining because they want to become U.S. citizens and be part of this huge country where they have the authority and the opportunity to work.
Kelly, I think you need a talk show.
I do need a talk show.
You're fired up, sister. I love it.
Saying the truth. You know, people come in here. I'm not trying to say that your callers don't know what they're saying. They definitely know what they're saying. Everyone's been there, done that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you just need somebody to go out there and speak the truth, not to be afraid of it, to be a man about it, because, truthfully, I don't even see any men around anymore. These men just nod their heads and say yes to everything that seems to be smooth and running.
You know what I call that, Kelly? I call that sect of people the sheeple.
But yes, the sheeple, because there are no men at all. I mean, probably 1 in 100 that will actually speak the truth and be for it and not be afraid of it.
Now, are you talking about those in Congress, or are you talking about men in general?
I'm talking about those men in Congress.
Okay.
But the men in general need to speak up, because, like I said, sitting down in your suburb, hometown, I'm not saying I'm not, because I do live in a suburb too, and just letting things fly by because it's not touching you and affecting you. It is. There are children and women being raped by the minute over there. By the minute.
That's right.
There is no progress. No, nothing at all.
And on Mother's Day, I think that's quite a poignant point there. In fact, I will be talking a little bit about Mother's Day. Are you a mother?
No, unfortunately, I'm not, but I do have a mother.
Okay, well, I'm going to talk about the state of moms coming up in the next hour. But, Kelly, thank you for calling from Flint. And remember, you can listen online, WRIF.com.
And keep the faith, and keep the truth.
You know we will.
You got me, and you've got 10 of my brothers and sisters listening to you from now on.
We love you for it, Kelly. Thank you so much. Have a great night. And you, I know she's going to keep the faith. We're going to take a quick break as we need to get one in before the top of the hour. And then we will take your calls. We have Jake from Rochester holding on the line, Jeff from Toledo, Matthew from St. Clair, Paul from Brighton. And it could be you, 313-298-WRIF. So much to talk about on Night Call tonight. I'm Julian Jordan in for Peter Werby.
This is WRIF.com.
Very cool, San Francisco. Thank you.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Peter Werby on vacation. I'm Julian Jordan, his on-air producer, filling in tonight. And answering your phones is Alan Slayer Beck, who you've probably heard rocking the Riff airwaves. He's going to be on after I am on and after a couple of interviews with Peter Werby. So he's kind of here. And I'm really excited about his 1 a.m. interview with John Sinclair, poet, author, anti-authoritarian. He's been in town in the last couple of weeks, probably, I think, on his way out to the New York area, doing a tour for his re-release of his book. And you may remember that book. You can hear all about it at 1 a.m. He was in the studios last week, and I was fortunate enough to come in and finally meet John Sinclair. And what a fascinating guy. So an interview with him, and then an interview after that about the electric guitar. So stay tuned for those incredible interviews with one Peter Werby. Peter will be back next week. And but for now, you've got me, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. You can also email calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and I need to get to those and actually read those. I have so many phone calls coming in, and let's get back to it. We'll go to Paul from Brighton, and he said he wants, he wants to talk about the war. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
Doing fine. How are you?
That's good. Well, all I can say is we're not even supposed to be in Iraq in the first place. We don't even have Osama bin Laden. And this is the whole reason why we went there, to get Osama bin Laden.
Instead. You mean Osama bin Forgotten?
Yeah, the guy that we, I guess, let bomb our own place, and now we're going to start a war to keep the big, these crazy people and the gas and everything else that is killing the environment. They keep working the way into getting all that oil from that country, bringing it here when we already produce our own oil. We don't have the capability to actually go 50% more on the outcome from them refining it.
Yeah, I think what it's really about is controlling the oil, controlling the price of oil, as Billy Bragg, the singer-songwriter from over the across the Great Pond, sings about.
Well, we could have had a lot easier time right now if they'd have listened to all the environmentalists back in the 70s, but they had to push the oil thing.
You mean us crazy tree huggers?
It's crazy tree huggers who told them we need to stop doing this, and they didn't listen, and now it's like, almost the time's up. Now we better do something about it, you know.
Yeah, now it's time when it's almost too late. And are you doing anything about it, Paul?
Oh, yeah, I'm always signing petitions for water and whatever comes around me.
Okay, good to hear.
And I can do only so much. I'm one person. That's all of us.
But a grassroots effort has been proven to work in the past, and we're hoping it works this time. I know I'm doing everything I can. Paul, thanks for calling Night Call tonight.
Oh, yeah. You have a good day.
All right. You too. A good night at that. And let's see. Let's go to, Jeff in Toledo, calling, wanting to talk about John McCain. Do you think he's lost his mind too, Jeff?
Hi, Jolene.
Hi.
How you doing?
Doing great.
Okay. Now, I am a person who is very much on the left,
okay,
very much with all of us here, you know. John McCain has not lost his mind.
Okay.
And I will tell, now,
I think he has, but
tell
me why.
I know, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I'm very glad that you do think he has.
Okay.
Because if you remember, when John McCain was running against Bush,
yeah,
the evangelicals put up a firewall in Michigan against him. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
Oh, Ted Nugent was involved in it.
No, geez.
It was unbelievable. Well, anyway, if you remember, about 9 months ago,
mm-hmm,
John McCain was spending a ton of time with Hillary and Bill Clinton.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Well, I'll tell you what's up with that. That's what I'm doing.
Great.
What is going on is, it's Bill Clinton versus Karl Rove. And the stakes are this. If Karl Rove gets his way, it's total fascist corporate dictatorship.
You got it.
If Bill Clinton gets his way, it's the United States of America. Okay? This is two ideals clashing here, and the stakes are huge.
And you're saying because Bill Clinton is actually the mind behind Hillary's campaign.
He is the mind of sanity.
Yeah, I agree.
In politics. Okay, so this is what's
going on. Who cares if he got his ear, you know, taken care of by Monica.
He told John McCain, look, you want to stop all of this consolidation, this corporation consolidation, which he came out of the Senate in tears over that.
I saw that. You mean Clinton?
John McCain.
He was in tears?
Yeah, he tried to stop the consolidation of the corporate consolidation in the communications industry.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know that Bill Clinton now says that that was his, well, other than, you know, Stupin,
right.
What's her name? It would be when he opened up the FCC.
Well, this is what's happening.
Yeah.
John McCain is crazy like a fox.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton told John McCain, look, you're going to be called the biggest flip-flopper in the world by the left. And that's what we want, because that's going to make these A to B thinking people in the right go, John's our guy. He's a war hero. He's this, he's that. What Bill is saying is, John, you get the nomination for the Republicans. We'll get Hillary the nomination for the Democrats. We win. We win. This corporate fascist machine stops right there. And if John McCain was to say, win the presidency, believe me, he's a good guy. He's not what he's looking to be, but see, he has to, and it will work, because the mentality of the evangelical right is not too swift.
You
see what I'm
point.
Saying?
So, I agree with that part, yeah.
Well, that's what it's psychological. And if John McCain and Hillary Clinton go at it, John McCain, if he got in the White House, everything that he said on this campaign, it's not going to be.
Well, it never is it?
No, it never is, but it's kind of good, because this is the thing. John McCain is trying on the right side to save us.
Do you think he's shooting himself in the foot, though?
Well, no, because, see, when it comes down to it, when it gets late and this thing gets heated up, it's the evangelical. See, George W. Bush is just the beginning of a long-term plan, and it's called the Project for the American Century, the New American Century.
I know of it.
It's a long-term fascist.
This is
nightmare.
The neocons.
It's a nightmare. It's a fascist takeover.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And they're trying to stop it.
God, I think they've already done it, though.
Well,
haven't they?
No, they're just chipping and chipping and chipping, you know, with the Supreme Court and the whole thing. They're just chipping away at checks and balances.
At the cost of the American people, at
that's
the cost
right.
of you and me, at the cost of
that's,
the people who don't have insurance.
That's right.
And
that's
on and on and on.
Not about it. But see, he saw that they crushed him. So he had to cozy up to them. And Bill said, look, it doesn't matter what happened during the last election. You have to cozy up to these people, because they're the ones who are running this whole administration. There's 155 of these freaks in the administration.
Yeah, he's doing a good job of it. And personally, I think John McCain just wants to be president, no matter what he says. He'll say anything to get there. And there's no way in hell I'm voting for him. But then again,
well,
you
I'm
probably could have.
For him.
You could have figured that out.
I'm not going to vote for him, but this is the thing. If it's him versus Hillary, then we will all win in the way that the fascist machine will be shut down.
Now, wait, Hillary, I mean, you know, you either love her or hate her.
She's got to do it, though.
I know. But
doing.
Don't you think she has just as many corporations throwing money her way?
Yeah, but this is the thing. You almost, in some way, nowadays, have to pander towards that corporate money or you will be wiped out. That's just the reality. What I'm saying is the stakes here are really, really high.
Yeah.
And I don't think that a lot of people can think that far into it to realize it. That's why you have 28% of these hayseeds, these idiots, who say George Bush, you know, oh, he's just the most wonderful. They don't even – there's no brains there.
Yeah. I don't know where it's coming from,
well,
but I have a feeling it's Fox News.
But these are the people that John McCain has to deal with, because these are the people that Rove hung his hat on. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, sure.
And Bush put them all in the administration, you know.
I all mean, his cronies are in there.
In fake college, you know. I mean, well, they did. I mean, Pat Robertson's college. You got to be kidding me.
Oh, this guy. I mean, come on, you know.
Right, but they're the very top of the pyramid here, Jillian.
He's a nutbag.
They're the ones who are running it, though.
Yeah, I saw something recently about the right wing, the religious right.
Right.
And the last election, and it was frightening how they went in. I mean, where's the separation of church and state?
Did you see Jesus Camp, Jillian?
What's that? I haven't seen Jesus Give Me Up.
Oh, if you see it, it's the most frightening.
I'm going to see it. I'm afraid,
Jeff. It's the most frightening movie you will ever
see.
Watch. Ever.
Well, it's in my queue, if you know what that means.
It's
on Netflix.
Abuse, right?
I have it coming.
It's child abuse.
It is. Well, you know what? I'm going to make sure I see that very soon. Okay, Jeff?
Good to talk to you.
You too.
Bye.
Thanks for calling.
Okay.
Night call. 313-298-WRIF. And some good points. I'm sorry. I think John McCain has lost his mind. Let's see, who's been holding? Oh, Jake from Rochester's been holding a long time. Jake, you're deploying to Iraq soon?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. What branch of the armed services are you in?
Marine Corps.
The Marine Corps. Okay. And what's on your mind tonight?
Nothing. Just wanted to say that a lot of people, I know nobody really supports Bush and everything, and
right.
I really don't. I don't support what he's doing. And
really?
The only thing is, though, I wish after 9/11 we would have just went in there, took care of business.
In where? Out. In where?
Afghanistan.
Okay, which we did. Sure. We did go in there, and we're still there.
Right, but I just think we should have never went to Iraq.
Do you think that it's okay that American soldiers are still dying in Afghanistan?
Well, I guess if we're still making a difference, then yes.
I wonder if we are, though, because initially we went in there and we said, we're going to get rid of the Taliban. We're going to get rid of the women are not going to wear their burqas anymore. It's going to be a democracy. Well, it's not happening. The Taliban, they are there in force. And you know what? I don't think they're ever going away.
Well, then it brings up the question, how do you fight people that don't really care to die?
Right. Right. Or who don't mind if they die.
Right.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
If they die, they're going to the seventh heaven or whatever.
Right, and don't they get like 8 hot babes or something? I don't know, there's some kind of...
I don't know.
Some kind of thing like that.
You know,
I don't know. It always has to do with sex in the end, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I joke. I tease.
Yeah, and my whole thing is, you know, if I die over there, then hopefully I die for a cause. And, you know, I have the flag on my casket and everything like that. And to me, that's a good honor to die for your country.
No, I don't want you to go, and I don't want you to die. How old are you, Jake?
22.
You're 22. And when are you leaving?
I'm not sure yet. I still got some training to go through. I'm going to be going into military police. I just got out of boot camp, Paris Island.
And what made you go into the Marine Corps?
What made me?
Yeah. Was it money?
Not much going on here, so.
So you needed money?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and people always kind of come down on me when I say that. Do you realize that a lot of these men and women are going in there because they want an education, they need money, they don't have any other outlets, and they, you know, really get down on me for making that statement, but it's true.
I guess it's mainly money, but... then, again, I can't afford college or anything like
right.
that. So my whole thing is if I go in, go through military police, come out, and then hopefully I can get a job as a police officer.
Okay, well, we're going to be thinking about you, Jake. Why don't you keep in touch with us?
All right.
Okay? You can send us emails from over there at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I'd be very interested in your progress.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. We'll be thinking about you, and good luck over there. Okay, Jake from Rochester, heading out to Iraq. I always get a little bit rattled when I hear things like that. John's calling from Grand Rapids. He's a Desert Storm vet, and he wants to talk about the Middle East. Hi, John. Welcome to Night Call.
Hey, Julie. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Hey.
You made it home, huh?
What's that?
You made it home. From Desert Storm?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. You know, I've heard a lot of interesting statements tonight, and it sounds like a lot of them are unfounded, many of which seem to be surrounded with paranoia, and the rest of them are just relative to ignorance. I'm not sure which, but...
Who do you think's paranoid? What are you saying? I'm not sure I'm grasping
well,
this.
You know, previous callers, Kelly, she seemed to have a... you know, minor hysteria going on.
Well, you know what? Okay, can I stop you there for a real quick second? I think oftentimes, and this is maybe because you're talking to a woman here, anytime a woman is screaming and yelling and upset, we are considered hysterical, and we are considered, you know, overly emotional. But you know what? I felt her pain. She is obviously extremely upset, and that's how she expresses herself. So
Julie,
I'm going to support Kelly.
Should share with me the last time that Kelly was in Iraq? When's the last time Kelly was in...
It's probably never, and you know what?
Kuwait City and all that other kind of stuff. My point is that it's all completely unfounded.
Okay, but
now
can say that. Hold on real quick. I think that you also have to realize that it's not completely unfounded. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to look and see what is going on over in Iraq. I've talked to enough vets of Iraq, whether it be Desert Storm or this current invasion and occupation. And you heard Al at the beginning of the show, who was in Vietnam, and he had to kill people himself, many people, and he's never going to be okay. So that's him. But other people who haven't been there, it doesn't take brain surgery to realize that it is messed up over there.
Oh, I'm with you. 110% about
okay.
How messed up it is over there. There's no question about that, Julian. I want those guys to come home as soon as they can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I left my last position, we were within a day's ride easy of Baghdad. And, you know, GW-41, they decided not to take that town for a reason, I think.
Yeah.
It's because they didn't have an exit strategy.
Remember that? He said that. And he said, we don't have one. And
you
he
know,
got
and
out of there.
Can I share something with you just from my heart?
Sure.
Is that fair?
Yes.
I was born in Macomb Community Hospital. Now,
okay.
Let me tell you Detroit something from somebody who's been 10,000 miles from home, and you just listen, people. Here's the deal. We are not conditioned to think like they are. Their mission is to kill us at any chance, at any opportunity, and that's what they're about.
Okay. Who are they? Who are you talking about? Because I know you're not talking about the civilians who are just sitting in their homes every day. The millions of people who are sitting there terrified to go to the market and even buy food for their dinner. Or the millions of people who are sitting in their homes in Iraq just waiting for someone to push down their door and storm them down and kill them just for being Iraqis.
Let me share with you the difference.
Who are they? Answer me that. No, you have to answer me that, John. Who is they?
I'm with you 100%. That's a great question, Julie. Let me share with you the difference between how we perceive the difference between church and state and how church and state is perceived in
Well, it wasn't before we went in there because you know that the party was non-religious.
Let me share it with you. The point is that you know, they have religious beliefs, and things are very different over there to the extent that the type of mission that we're bringing, though it's not popular, I mean, somebody is holding stock in these companies when Exxon gets a $39.5 million profit in a quarter. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, what about Halliburton?
You know what I'm saying? None of that stuff's good. There was another point that was made earlier, and it was about how the people in the state of Michigan are suffering.
Yes.
And here's, let's talk about the people in the state of Michigan are suffering. They're suffering because of NAFTA. The day that NAFTA was signed into
law. I'm with you. Yeah.
The day that the people in the state of Michigan began to hurt on a grand, grand scale across the board. We've seen corporations disintegrate. You know, there's a tremendous burden out there, and you know, we've got people that are hurting in state of Michigan at a tremendous level.
Amen.
They need some help. They really do.
Yeah, we need help right here at home. And sure, maybe, things started, well, I think things started probably way before NAFTA. But this has only compounded the situation for those of us here in the United States. And you know what? For those people, those innocent civilians who just want to live their life in Iraq, no one, well, people like me, and I know there are a lot of people who actually give a hoot. I remember talking to my Republican father, and I said, Dad, don't you care about those people who are just, you know, in their homes and want to work and want to provide for their children and want to get proper health care? These people don't even have lights and plumbing, half of them. And he goes, I don't care about those people. Well, that is the mentality that I'm talking about. Those are the 28% of people that don't get it.
We need to care more. And in fact, you know, the problem is that, you know, this administration talks about how they were going to reach out across the board.
Yeah.
You want to talk about people that are disillusioned.
Huh.
I've got a Bush Cheney sticker on the back of my truck that
what?
Embarrasses me.
Well, take it off.
It embarrasses me. Well, just, you know, just because there have been some errors, it doesn't mean that I'm going to take it off. But the point is that the misrepresentation of how this whole war was presented. They said to all the veterans, they said, you know what? We got this going on and so forth. I've got my name in the Big Rapids Pioneer going on record in defending this thing. And then this thing comes off. There's no exit strategy.
Right.
None. You've got corporate America. You've got Exxon that makes $40 billion.
Yeah.
We've got people in the state of Michigan that are suffering like never before.
That's right. Can't even pay for their gas now. Can't even keep their lights on. People are losing their houses by the thousands.
Where are these people coming to help the people in the state of Michigan? And the people in the state of Michigan are suffering. You know what? In the state of Michigan, in 2006, we were the only state that lost value in real estate.
Yeah.
You know, Detroit is in a conundrum with this foreclosure problem.
And people are all over the United States are suffering at that. And you know what? I have a lot of phone calls to get to. I really appreciate all of your comments, John.
Thank you so much, Julie. God bless you, and thank you so much. We love you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you very much. And thanks for calling NICAL, 313-298-WRIF. And, ooh, boy, Ben and Novi, you've been waiting a long time. Let's get you on the air. You want to talk about loose change? What's that mean?
Oh, the conspiracy theory movie that the lady from Flint mentioned.
Oh, yeah, I wrote that down. It was Loose Change, the movie. Okay, I see what you're saying. So quickly, I forget.
The movie, I saw that movie, and it's a conspiracy theory movie.
Yeah, see, I'm not into the conspiracy kind of thing, but I'll take a look anyway.
Well, yeah, that's all it is a conspiracy theory. It makes no sense. It has no facts in it. And I saw the whole thing, and I didn't like it.
Did you like, say, Fahrenheit 9/11?
Actually, no, I did not.
Well, why not?
Well, there was one scene where Roger Moore went up to senators and tried to get them to enlist their sons in the army. I hated that scene.
Well, come on, he's just doing it for shock factor, and he's doing it to prove a point. He doesn't think they're actually going to do it.
But people said that, oh, the senators aren't sending their kids to war. And the reason is because it's the kid's decision whether he wants to enlist in the army or not.
Well, there are two senators. I think there's two that have kids over there. In fact, I'm trying to remember the name of the one who carries his kid's combat boots over his shoulders. I like that guy. You know, at least there's one out of all of them. There should be more.
Well, there shouldn't have to be. I mean, I joined the Marine Corps when I was 18. It was a volunteer choice. Nobody forced me into doing it.
Why'd you do
Nobody
it?
Walked
Why did you do
dad.
It?
Why did I do it?
Yeah.
I was 18 and I lived a very sheltered life, so I wanted to have some kind of life experience.
Did you get it?
Oh, yeah, I got a lot.
Okay. But you're out now?
I served in 5 years. I got out, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're not going over there, Ben.
Oh, why not?
I'm glad you're not going because you know why? You can live and be here and call me.
Yeah, boy.
And be free.
I was in Iraq for a year, and it wasn't a bad experience.
Really?
Was that a
long time ago? Because it's bad every day over there now, dude.
2005 to 2006.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad that you lived through it.
Well, I mean, I've been offered chances to go back, and I've been debating about it, whether I want to or not, just waiting for a good offer.
Yeah, don't do it. That's my suggestion. All right. Ben, thanks for calling about Loose Change. Go ahead.
There was something else I wanted to say, but it just slipped my mind.
Oh, it did? That happens. Sometimes when you get on, you're like, ugh, what was I going to say? I understand. Well, you know what? If you think of it, call back next week, okay?
All right.
All right. Ben and Novi calling in saying, Loose Change. It's just a conspiracy theory. We'll see. I'm gonna watch that definitely sometime this week when I can fit it in. Let's go to Brian, who's been waiting patiently in Pontiac, and he wants to talk about John Sinclair, who will be in an interview about 35 minutes from now, 1 o'clock this morning. Peter Werby interviewed him earlier this week, and what do you have to say?
Hi, Julie.
Hi, Brian.
I've had quite a good history. I met John back in 1966.
Cool.
In,
he moved into Romeo, Michigan, and rented this big old funeral home and had the MC5 and the up band practicing and everything like that.
Nice.
Before he moved to Ann Arbor and stuff. And we partied together in Amsterdam since I helped him hook up with High Times magazine. And,
yeah, he lives and, there now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, and it's, so he's a really, really great person, you know. And
yeah.
I can't believe we started that hash bash back in 34 years ago, and it's still not legal, you know, but he's the one that got the fine down from $15, now it's $50 for anything under an ounce in Ann Arbor if you're not on school property or anything.
So it's still that way, okay.
Yeah, it's still that way. And, but like I say, back in 81, I joined the Army, worked for Central Intelligence Agency.
Really?
And they were talking at that time about going to war with Iraq way back then. And they were telling us that all the Iraqis are brought up to hate us from the beginning.
See,
when they're little kids, you know.
And they're telling you that, and it's not true.
Right. And you know, since then, I've met people from Iraq.
Yep.
And that I've done construction for and homes for. And, you know, and these people, they're afraid to even go see their family. They're scared to death for their family. They, you know, 8 years ago, they were going there regularly to see their family. Now they're afraid to even go there because there's so much chaos.
Oh, yeah,
and
absolutely.
Basically, we're the ones that created the Civil War there.
Mm-hmm.
And we went in there under false pretenses, you know. But, you know, it's just, it's like I say, it's total chaos out there. And we're the ones that created it. And I support the soldiers, don't get me wrong. I'm prior service, like I said.
Well, yeah, we want them back here. We want them alive.
Right, right. And, you know, and the thing is, we haven't got Bin Laden yet. And he's the one that really orchestrated the 9/11.
You want
to
know my Bin Laden theory is that even if we got him, it doesn't matter. There are so many angry followers of him. We have been creating a society of baby Bin Ladens through what we've done over in the Middle East, and I don't see an end in sight. I believe they're here in this country right now, and if anyone doesn't, I think that you kind of got your head in the sand.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, we built the bunkers and everything when we were in cahoots with Bin Laden trying to fight off the Russians, you know. And so
we were. See, first we love you, then we hate you, then we'll get you. All right, Brian.
All
thanks
right.
A lot for calling in.
Okay.
We appreciate it. You have a wonderful evening. And I think we're going to take a quick break. We have full lines, it looks like. We have Roger in Waterford, someone calling in from Roseville who wants to talk about rock star moms. I'm not sure what that's about. Gary in Indiana, Brian in Pontiac, Ron in Livonia. And we have Casey calling from New York. So we're going to take all of your calls coming up next on Night Call.
WRIF.com.
WRIF.com. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Peter Werby has the night off. I'm Julian Jordan, taking your phone calls, talking about what else? Iraq, it just seems to always overtake everything. Well, it should, because it is one of the big stories, one of the biggest stories. It's what is dividing the nation, but dividing is really stretching it, because Bush's approval rating is now 28%. If you're one of those, I want to know why you're still supporting this guy. I really want to know. Let's head on back to the phones. I'm going to try to breeze through these because we only have about 20 minutes left of the show, and we have a full docket. So we'll go to Gary, who's been waiting in Indiana, and here we go. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Hey.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Well, I was going to say something about Bush and actually this whole administration.
Okay.
The thing that actually scares me is, with everything that they've done, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I've seen Loose Change and, you know, I kind of like that one caller. I don't think it makes a lot of sense. But, you know, the thing that scares me is it seems like they are positioning themselves with, you know, the secret prison that they're having built by Bechtel and Halliburton, and I guess that's here in the United States, the way it looks.
Yeah, and you've heard about secret prisons all over the world.
Well, this one is here, and it's supposed to be able to hold like 100,000 people.
Really?
You know, and, you know, the thing is, I don't think the next election's going to come. I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, he's given himself, through the Republican Congress, he's given himself the ability to declare martial law for pretty much anything. He has taken, he's revoked posse comitatus. I don't think it's going to happen.
What do you mean by that? Are you foreseeing the end of the world? What are you talking about?
No, I'm foreseeing the end of the democracy that we have. I don't think that there is going to be an election.
What do you think there's going to be instead?
A dictatorship.
Oh, well, there already kind of is, right?
Well, yeah, there is, but I think that, I think what's going to happen is prior to this next election, he's going to declare martial law and going to cancel elections.
Oh, God, well, I hope not. I hope not. You know, that is Bush's dream. I remember back when he was first, selected by the Supreme Court so many years ago, that he said the ultimate situation is a dictatorship. He said it.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, I mean, you know, they put into place, pretty much like what Hitler done. I mean, I'm not comparing.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
Well, no, but you know, there are people who will call and say, you know, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, I don't think in actual fact that, you know, there were the enabling laws that were passed in Germany. And those pretty much those same laws have been passed here.
Pretty scary, isn't it, Gary?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, if you actually look, I mean, if you go and look at history and you look at those actual laws,
mm-hmm,
in Germany, and you compare them to what's happened here, they're pretty much the same. And the simple fact is that people say, well, that's a conspiracy theory. And it's really not. I mean, if you just actually look at the actual facts on those two, you compare them, there's not that much difference.
All right. Well, thank you, Gary, for calling in and being patient and waiting for me to get to your call, calling in from Indiana. And we sure appreciate you calling.
Have a good night.
All right, Gary. Gary, probably listening online. That's what I want to say. WRIF.com is where you can listen. You can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and you can call at 313-298-WRIF as we head to Roseville. This ought to be interesting because we haven't really been talking about rock star moms. Let's see where this leads. Hello, who's this?
First of all, I'd like to complain about all the sex on the television.
The sex on the television?
Yes, I keep falling off.
You what?
I, I would like to take this platform right now to ask you, Jolene, if you would plug your rock concert this upcoming Saturday.
I want to know who this is.
I'll hang up and listen for your answer. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that was interesting. I'm not sure who that was, but and there was no name, but thank you for the opportunity to plug my show at the New Way Bar Saturday night in Ferndale. Going to do some political content for you, some political songs that I wrote, and the one that you may have heard on this program is Baghdad and Beyond, which I was fortunate enough to have Vinny Dombrowski from Sponge and Crud and the Orbitsons. He sang on that with me. In fact, he also played drums on another track on my CD. So if you want to check that out, you can find out some information on peterwerby.com, or you can go to myspace.com/JoleneJordanMusic. You can go to WRIF.com, go to lineup, you can find me, and it's all there. So I'd love to see you all out there. That would be absolutely fabulous. And the sex on the TV, well, I don't know. I really just don't know how to answer that. Oh, you gotta love live radio. Roger's in Waterford, and he's calling Night Call at 313-298-WRIF, and his topic is the war. Roger, are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I am. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine. It's good to talk to you.
Long time riff listener.
Yeah, great.
Basically all day and I don't sleep much, but...
You don't?
No, I don't.
Is it because of the state of the world? Because that's what keeps me awake at night, Roger.
Well, I'm prior service. I was a sergeant in the Marine Corps.
Okay.
I was in Somalia.
Oh, wow. So I bet that was an eye-opener.
Yeah, that was. Absolutely. But nonetheless, it makes a habit of being an early riser.
Oh, yes.
And I have a...
what do they call that when they wake you up in the morning? The trumpet?
Reveille.
Thank you.
And believe it or not, the Army actually salutes it.
Yeah.
At least they did in jump school. I didn't understand that, but we did in jump school. Well,
okay.
I don't know. Wake me up at 5 in the morning in my sweats on and let's salute Reveille.
Okay. I think that sounds very tiring, but
yes.
Go ahead. What do you think about the war?
Anyway, I understand the frustrations and the
anger,
lack of progress. Sure, all the above with the situation with Iraq and in our situation in the world. But at the same token, what are they doing to help themselves?
And are you talking about the Iraqi people?
And the reason why that it compelled me to call you was because you're like, well, what about, the people like you and me who just want to get along, who just want to do whatever?
They can't do anything, though. They're helpless.
Yes, they can.
No, they can't.
No, think about it. If you got a bunch of stuff going on in your neighborhood, you're going to get with your neighbors. You're going to go root out what the heck is going on. If you have any ambition, you're going to go after them. You're going to clean it up.
I think that's much easier said than done, Roger, because these people are outnumbered by guns. They're outnumbered by guns. They're outnumbered by service people. And I'll tell you why the Iraqi quote-unquote police, I'll tell you why they're not doing anything. They're not showing up because they don't want to die.
Well, what about when we became a nation ourselves?
Oh, well...
I mean,
I don't have long enough to go into that.
It's comparing apples and oranges to great. However, you can't say that we weren't outgunned. You can't say that
we weren't outgunned.
I mean, we put militias together. We did what we had to do because we believed in something and followed through with it. Now,
okay.
I don't think
it's our position to go across
the world to be conquerors and force our beliefs or whatever upon someone else.
Right.
But in the context of what you're saying, that, hey, everyone just wants to get along, and I agree with that, but there's got to be a point to where, hey, you know what, enough is enough, and, I have a right to live here, I have a right to stand here and not get shot at,
yeah.
And dang it, if I'm going to, then I'm going to have to address it myself.
Okay, well, I think that is it's wishful thinking, and but I think it is a complete impossibility. The people over there are helpless. They may be armed in their own homes, but we're armed a lot bigger, and I just cannot agree with that. I'm sorry. I think it's gone beyond can we all just get along? I think for these people, it's can I survive in my own home? Can I get some clean freaking water? Can I get some damn electricity? Can I get some safety? Do I have any safety at all? No, they don't. But thank you, Roger, for calling in tonight, call. We appreciate your call, 313-298-WRIF. As we go to Casey, who is in New York. Let me get to you here a second. Hold on, Casey. All right. Click. Here we go. Casey's calling from New York, wants to talk about Afghanistan, and thank you for calling all the way from New York. Casey?
Well, actually, I'm on Interstate 75 in Michigan.
But no! But you're a New Yorker.
Sort of.
But you're a native Michigander?
I'm a native Michigander.
Okay, Casey, what's up?
What's up? I just wanted to say, I've been listening since St. Clair on my way home.
Line a long time. I appreciate it.
And I've been perturbed because I disagree with a lot of things being said tonight. But
okay, by who? By me or by the listeners?
Probably the vast majority of just everything being said tonight.
Okay. Are you saying you're pro-war?
I wouldn't say I'm pro-war because I agree with you. Everybody just wants to get along. But in reality, that's just, not going to happen.
Right.
But,
well, they just want to live a normal life, and that's not going to happen.
Well, no, it's not. But my husband has been in Afghanistan for 16 months now.
He's still there?
Yes, he's coming home
my
the end of this month.
Oh, good.
But you had questioned whether or not we were making progress there, and we very much are making progress there. The people are thankful that we are there.
Okay, no, I don't think all of them are, though. I can't agree with you. They can't all be happy we're there.
Well, not everybody's happy that we're there here.
Right.
You can't please everybody. But
well, that's true.
People, we're providing jobs for them over there, helping them to build means to support their lives and to help themselves.
I hope
the Iraqi people can help themselves, but they can.
No, that's not true. They cannot help themselves when they're living in fear and they can't even leave their homes. And I don't think that
they
people are grasping
their homes
that.
Before we went there.
They could a lot easier. It's a lot worse now. It's escalated to the point of complete chaos. And before, it was a completely different situation. The markets were thriving. They had, we went in there and destroyed these historical buildings, these, art galleries and libraries, and we destroyed things that have been around for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. We destroyed their infrastructure. These people can't even have basic things like lighting and plumbing. Do you think that's okay? No, really, I want your answer.
No, I don't think it's okay, but I don't think you have all the facts. I don't think anybody has all the facts.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I do spend just about 8 hours a day studying this, and from sources other than CNN, okay? So
okay.
I do feel that I do have some basis to what I'm saying here, Casey.
Well, I'm not saying you don't, but I don't think you have all the answers. And
Who
I
does?
Don't think
who does? Do you?
Who does? If I had the answers, I would have my own TV show.
Right, there you go. No one has all the answers, and it's obvious George Bush has none of the answers.
Okay. I'm also one of your 28% of the idiots.
Why are you still supporting him? What is your reasoning?
I'm not going to defend that, but...
Okay, because you don't have any defense, do you?
No, I have my reason, but I don't feel I need to defend it to
okay,
the rest
well,
of the nation.
All right, there's your answer. Thanks for calling, Casey. We appreciate you calling in. We wish the best to your husband, and we hope he comes back in one piece. And I mean that wholeheartedly. I care about the troops over there so much that I want him to live. Isn't that crazy? Let's go to Livonia with Ron, who says, ooh, this is a pretty strong statement. He says he does not support the troops. Now, tell us what you mean, Ron.
That's right. First of all, let's premise that the reason that this country and the world is suffering from Bush and before Bush Clinton and then Bush Daddy is because the Americans are lazy and cowards and have not decided that they need to have a general strike. They have general strikes around the world. They stop their governments from doing things. France had a very successful general strike just recently.
Yes.
Israel, which is not a model for the world, nevertheless, the government tried to shove things down their throat. They had a successful general strike. We have never had a general strike in this country. We don't have consumer strikes in this country,
right,
despite the fact that $2 trillion of taxpayer money. I said
$2 trillion.
Billion,
that's right.
Trillion.
That's right.
$2 trillion plus dollars cannot be accounted for. The Amira idiots continue to send their money to Washington, their taxes. This is insanity. Now, with regard to the troops, let's get this straight. If you're against the war, you cannot be supporting the troops. That is absolutely cognitive dissonance.
I don't agree. I don't agree, but go ahead.
Let me explain why that is the case.
Okay, make it quick.
The troops are the war. The war is not occurring without the troops.
Well, it's because they're being told what to do. They're being told.
No, they don't. They have a choice. They can refuse. Don't give me that. Now, that's the problem, Julian. You propagate a cult of irresponsibility. Oh, they're just little victims. And by the way, the guys who go over there specifically because they want to come back and get a college education, that's criminality of the highest degree.
I agree.
Look, they are over there committing war crimes. But the worst, but the first crime they committed is that they went to war when no war was declared.
Yeah.
Every American citizen has the fundamental responsibility to defend and obey the Constitution. It is above all else. When Bush makes a comment contrary to the Constitution, it is the duty of the military to refuse. When they do not refuse, they become traitors. Now, everybody fighting an unconstitutional war is a traitor. I'm sick and tired of the people who make excuses for people who do not make the choices. Here's what we have. We have people who, when they're ordered to fight an unconstitutional war, decide to go and do that instead of saying, no, I won't go. If they don't go, they may end up on the brig, but of course if they do that by the tens of thousands, there will be no prison time for them whatsoever. That will be the end game. There will be no war. We have had the ability to stop this war, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the war against Yugoslavia, the war in Vietnam. All of these wars could have been stopped if the American people were responsible, but they are criminals at heart, and that has to stop. They have to examine themselves and understand they have the responsibility to say no, and they can say no.
Okay, strong words from Ron in Livonia. Boy, that could really spark a few phone calls, and too bad we only have a few minutes left. I'm going to try to breeze through a couple more phone calls. I know Dan in Troy has been holding on the line for a while. Dan, you are calling about humans evolving in a peaceful way?
Yes. Julian, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine.
Wow. What that guy in the past just said is amazing.
I know. Yeah. But we all have an opinion, don't we? And it's a talk show. We're talking about that. I don't agree with him, but
get a collective bigger heart in this beautiful world that we all have.
Say that again? I'm sorry.
I just wish someday all of us in this big collective heart could be more perspective, I should say retrospective, and just look at what we do in our actions on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
It's a simple, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think that that compassion is definitely is something strong that a lot of people are unable at this point to achieve. Would you agree?
Yeah, a lot.
Okay.
Definitely.
All right, Dan. Thanks for calling in. We appreciate it. We hope for peace. We hope for peace. And for all of you who think that it's impossible, well, then it will be if that's the way that we think. We've got to, you know, have a little more of a positive attitude and get out there and do something rather than sitting in front of the TV and watching Fox News and CNN and thinking that you've got it all figured out. Because trust me, none of us probably have it all figured out. Let's go to Jim and Romeo. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling Night Call. What's on your mind tonight?
How you doing, Julian?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
First thing I want to tell you real quick is that this show is tremendous.
Well, thank you.
You have hit. Nobody's ever told you that in the 2 hours you've been on. You have hit a new. Night Call has hit a new level of greatness.
Well, that is much appreciated.
I hope to God. I mean, Werby is nice. You know, he's
Werby's. Listen, he's my mentor, and he'll be back next week.
Oh, great. Whatever. But he's the snap. You're the crackle of the pot.
I'll tell him that. I'll call him later
I'll
and tell him.
I'll call you next week if I can get through. I didn't think I was going to be able to get through this week.
Well,
this
it's very
show,
tough.
You are letting the people talk, and this is what makes it, and you have a quick, fantastic, genius wit.
Oh, my gosh.
That comes right on.
Wait, let me pop my head really quick.
I just want to say that to you. You deserve it, man. You have done a fantastic job.
Jim, thank
fantastic.
You.
Fantastic.
Thank
and
you.
And I want to say one thing about Ron and Livonia.
Okay.
The man is a genius. I love what he said.
Oh, you mean how he was saying he doesn't support the troops.
The man is using common sense. He thinks like me. And if you have my number, give Ron my number. I'd like him to call me. That man has said more than anybody I've ever heard.
He said that he believes that the troops are war criminals. I say that they are over there doing what they're told. And for the majority of them, they're afraid to say anything, you know, back if they disagree with this. They're scared young men and women who are probably frightened for their lives. Well, they are frightened for their lives every day. They don't know who the hell they're shooting at. They don't know what the hell's going on over there. How can they be expected to?
Right. See, Julian, remember 3 or 4 years ago when the government of the United States, which is us people, we are the government. And remember, the government of the in Washington, D.C. is only as good as its people.
That's right. Okay. And the highest form of patriotism is to question your
That's
government.
Right.
So get out there and do it,
so
Jim.
Open your
thank
mouth.
You.
Just remember, Julian.
Yeah, Julian. It's Julian, by the way.
Julian?
Yeah, you got it.
Listen, because I listen to you when you do the records, too.
Yes, I rock and talk.
I know it's the same voice.
It is the
I
same
mean,
voice.
You're an Oprah. You're making $20 million a year.
Yeah, right. And you know what? If I made $20 million a year, I would give so much of it away.
Well,
thank you.
I can sense you got a good heart. I can sense it on the phone. But one last thing I'll say.
Sure.
Remember 3 years ago when the government said, we're going to shock and awe them.
Yeah.
Now we're the ones in shock and awe.
Yes, we are. That's a good point. Jim, thanks for calling Night Call tonight. And you have a great one. I appreciate your kind words. It means a great deal to me. Peter will be happy that you approve. A couple more phone calls we're going to quick take care of, and then we are going to get to that interview with John Sinclair. We're going to go right now to Stephen Melvindale. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling Night Call tonight.
Hey, how you doing? I've been in active duty for about 4 years. I'm now currently in the Michigan Army National Guard.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've done one tour over there already. I volunteered for another tour. I'm leaving in August.
Wow.
And let me say, you know, my first tour over there wasn't fun. You know, it was a while ago. So
how could anything like that be fun?
No, it's not. And, you know, most of us don't want to go. And let me say this, though.
Yeah.
You know, people say we're not doing anything to stop it. You know, I single-handedly signed a petition with 40,000 other soldiers saying we thought this war was unjust and unfair.
Good for you.
Let me also say that while I was there, I single-handedly helped build 13 different hospitals in 13 different areas, and I also helped build 7 different schools.
Do you think those are all still standing?
You know, I'm not saying they all are, and I'm not saying that they all haven't been attacked, because I've been there when they have been attacked.
Right.
But let me say, my brother leaves for his second tour in August also, and we don't go over there because we want to. We go over there for each other.
So, you know, will you be together over there? Will you?
No, we will not be together over there. We'll be in two different provinces. But I will say, as a brother, as a soldier, you know, you're not there for one person. You're there for everybody that's over there doing what they got to do. So for some of us, this is our life. This is what we do.
Yeah, I know. I know.
We say, you know, we enjoy what we do. We don't enjoy being in war.
No.
That's for sure.
I can't imagine.
And you know, I've been there when we've lost a few people, and it's not fun.
Right. Well, I've been invited to Baghdad many times with peace organizations, and I wouldn't, you know what? The reason I didn't go is because I couldn't do it to my parents.
Right.
They would not last through me being over there, even if it were a week. But right. More power to you. We wish the best to you, Steve.
Yeah,
thanks.
And, you know, can I say one more thing?
Sure.
I'd like to say that if you don't support us, you don't support your country. I understand we're not there for the right reasons.
Yeah.
But, you know, you got sons, brothers, husbands, fathers over there that are doing what they got to do.
Yes.
And, you know.
Sisters, mothers.
That's it, too.
Right. On Mother's Day, right.
Yeah.
Okay, Steve, thanks for calling. We appreciate it, and best of luck to you over there. And one more call. We're going to wrap it up tonight. We'll take Fred's call from Detroit. Hi, Fred. Thanks for calling Night Call.
Good morning, Julene.
Good morning.
I called you and Peter a while back, and I believe I told you guys that you have to remember those Bush supporters, those are the folks that have a vested interest.
Oh, yeah.
In the,
money.
You know, in the military machine. And
oh,
the
yeah.
Oil machine,
the military industrial complex
and
oil.
Few that don't, they have picked their little niche. Their little niche issues like abortion.
Yes.
They don't care about, you know, the whole big picture.
They don't care about me as a woman. I know that.
Right.
They
right.
don't give one crap about me as a woman.
They have that one track mind thing going.
Right. Absolutely.
They drive on.
Well, we'll have to just keep remembering that, right, Fred?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Thanks for calling. Need to get going and get some commercials in here, and then John Sinclair with Peter Werby. Thank you to you, Fred, for calling the show.
All right.
And thank you to everyone for calling tonight. It has been wonderful filling in for Peter Werby. I'm Julene Jordan. We'll be back next week with Night Call. Stay tuned for Peter Werby and John Sinclair on 101 WRIF.
This is WRIF.com.
could open myself straight. And it's been a while since I said I'm sorry. And it's been a while since I've seen the way the candles light your face. And it's been a while, but I can still remember just
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you and an absolute pleasure to bring an old friend to our microphones. He's been on the Peter Werby Show before. He published a book in 1972. It's just been republished. It's John Sinclair. John, welcome to back to the Peter Werby Show.
It's my pleasure to be here, Pete.
And I had, I don't want to take up too much time, but I should tell people that you are an author. You are a journalist. Early on in your career, you were a writer for Downbeat Magazine. You were a columnist for the Fifth Estate newspaper.
Fifth Estate.
1967, I think it was, the Detroit Free Press labeled you the king of the hippies. I like that.
Yeah.
Is that one of your prized...
No, that was a short-lived epithet.
Epithet?
In fact...
I'd love to be the king of the hippies.
Well, you know, you could have did it. I mean, it wasn't, I mean...
Well, you can't have two kings.
Yeah, well, but right. I mean, it wasn't up to us. I wasn't, as you will recall, I didn't have a sign.
Or a crown.
This was something that was made up by the newspaper.
Right. John Sinclair managed what's called here in the release, Avant Rock MC5.
That was their term.
It is.
Peter, when I first met them,
they called themselves that. Right. Well, you remember, they, several of them, lived in my building.
Yeah, exactly. I was pointing that out to Adam, who lives right behind there.
Right. And, in fact, the MC5 bassist, Michael, I have his dining room table. So Michael Davis is here. And, well, what else? A blues scholar, a jazz scholar, and author.
You left out poet.
And poet.
That's my principal identity.
That's how you entered things in many ways.
And also, yeah.
That was when you formed the Detroit Artists Workshop, a very important cultural undertaking in Detroit in the mid-1960s. Anyway, the book is Guitar Army, Street Writings, Prison Writings, John Sinclair, and it was published in 1972, a beautiful edition, and a different but still lovely edition.
Thank you.
Brand new on Guitar Army, Rock and Revolution with MC5 and the White Panther Party.
That was the publisher's.
Yes, I knew. I knew you would.
Thank you.
But
mine was called Street Writings / Prison Writings.
On the cover of the original one, there's John Sinclair, enormously long-headed of hair, smoking an enormous doobie, and on the cover of this one, a great shot of the band that you were a part of. Why the change? Why not still John Sinclair smoking that huge doobie?
I don't know. Well, when we made the 1972 edition for Alan Douglas at Douglas Books, we controlled the whole thing. That was our concept at the time. So Gary Grimshaw designed that book with my careful input at every stage of the way, first in prison, and then after I got out, I worked with him. So we made that exactly how we want it to be designed. This one is 35 years later. I was so tickled that somebody had the idea to put it back out again that he suggested you want to change the cover, you want to take a few things out and put more pictures in, and I said, great. So I didn't really have a hands-on approach to it. If I had, of course, it would reflect my outlook more than theirs, but I'm happy to be published. I'm just trying to be an author now.
Well, still...
I don't need to supervise the marketing and the printing, and, you know, I mean, I...
Lots of new photographs in there from that period in Detroit in the 1960s, 1970, Ann Arbor. And in October of 1970, the FBI referred to the White Panthers the group that you and others founded as sort of a parallel group to the Black Panthers, as, quote, potentially the largest, most dangerous of revolutionary organizations in the United States.
Wow.
What do you think? You think that was accurate?
No, but I mean, I was certainly inflated even beyond our own inflated self-analysis, you know.
Well,
potentially, I think, was the key word there.
Pun plamando.
In other words, if you don't give us more money to hunt these guys down with, they could develop into this, but we could nip them in the bud with COINTELPRO.
Well, when I interviewed Pun Plamondon about his autobiography, Lost to the Ottawa, he said that the left, the formal left in Detroit, saw the work of the White Panthers and the MC5 and all the other institutions, and if you call them that, that you folks had put together. He said that we were sort of seen as countercultural clowns by formal left, but in reality, with our music and our literature, we spoke to tens of thousands of youth every week with our music.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't have to figure out what schools to run down the halls with the tops off, you know.
That was what some of them mean. That's what the weather underground did.
They were kind of a bizarro version of the White Panther Party. I thought they had forced random sex, whereas we had it because we liked each other, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, with all due respect.
Well, when you look back 35 years
later, I think we staked out the position on the cultural side pretty well.
Well, 35 years later, when you look at the material in Guitar Army, are you proud of it all? Is there anything you wince at, or is it...
Yeah. No, I'm not proud of it. I mean, that's something I wrote when I was much younger.
Listen, don't be modest. I think you should be proud
of
it. Oh,
no, Pete, I've had a lot of emotional distance from this book for a long time because my feelings are so mixed, because although it's exhilarating to recall those times when things were swelling upwards. At the end of this, I ended up doing 2.5 years in prison. So sometimes I'd look at the book and say, maybe I shouldn't have said all that stuff. It wasn't accurate. I mean, if it had all been wonderful and then we had removed the government and placed a people's government in, and when you got sick, you could just go to the hospital and get treatment, I would feel more prouder. But a lot of this youth wasn't ever, as you were never reluctant to point out at the time, youth is not going to be a class. Rock and roll is not going to be a weapon of cultural revolution. So, I mean, I wrote these things, and I meant every word of it at the time. But now, it's like when you start out in a movie, and you already seen the end, and the guy's going to go down the hail of bullets, you know, but at the beginning, he's going to take over the world, and you think, well, it didn't really come out like that. So I finally read a piece last night that I had to stop. I had to stop and jump to the end because it was too nuts.
Well, 40 years.
Well, look.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can we say, for the purpose of full disclosure, that you were my editor during much of this period?
Yeah.
You handled some of these things.
As a columnist for the Fifth Estate newspaper.
You were the editor.
I was just going to say, this is also, this year is the 40th anniversary of the Detroit Uprising, Riot, Rebellion, called different things, and I still think your column on describing it. I mean, there's been a lot
written. Light My Fire.
Light My Fire by the Doors.
That's one of the better things I ever wrote.
What did it say? Rose up to number one in the ranks, and the people of Detroit responded by burning the city down. John Sinclair is my guest on the Peter Werby Show.
I was trying to relate the music to the political thing, you know.
Brand new edition of Guitar Army, and it's subtitled Rockin' Revolution with MC5 and the White Panther Party. Originally, as you said, John, it was street writings and prison writings. You've mentioned a couple of times about going to prison. 2.5 years, of course, to us on the outside, it was all very heroic. It was a little different on the inside, I'm sure. Yeah. But tell people why you were in there for 2.5 years.
Well, why? That's a bigger question. But I was sentenced to 9.5 to 10 years in prison for possession of 2 marijuana cigarettes.
Yeah. Sort of.
That was the legal base. I was charged originally with giving the 2 joints to an undercover Detroit policewoman. But after 2.5 years of fighting this and trying to get the law declared unconstitutional prior to trial, when I was actually ready to go to trial, this charge carried a minimum mandatory 20-year sentence on conviction, sale or giving away marijuana, and which I thought was the strong part of our case, because how could somebody look at that and say, this is appropriate. That's cruel and unusual punishment, if there ever was any, in our whole annals of jurisprudence, you know. So, but the day before the trial, they dropped the, we were ready to go to trial on the sales charge, and they dropped it. So, but that was very severe, those sentences, and 10 years for possession.
Yeah, 9.5 to 10 years. He didn't want to be.
Well, yeah, they didn't want to tie up a parole officer with a mad dog like myself.
Well, I was there at the sentencing, and yeah, it was chilling.
Well. Yeah,
it was extraordinary, chilling.
You may laugh, Mr. Sinclair.
That's what said, Judge.
But you'll have a long time to laugh. I'll never forget those words.
Neither will I. Actually, neither. And you yelled.
Yeah, I sealed my own fate. Yeah. You will die, you punk, you pig.
Well, it didn't matter by then. What was he going to do, sentence you to 10 to 10?
Well, I mean, it was hard to get an appeal bond, though, you see.
Yeah, he did get an
added. I didn't really add to my own, desirability as an appeal bondee.
Well,
In fact, I couldn't get an appeal bond for 2.5 years until John Lennon came here.
Well, I want to talk to you about that. I will just say, though,
and that's what it took to get an appeal bond in this state.
Judge Robert Colombo of the Old Recorders Court sentenced John Sinclair to 9.5 to 10 years. The Fifth Estate newspaper, which John wrote, we both of us worked with, we immediately
wrote for.
What did I say?
Well, you said work. I think you got 25 a week or something.
Yeah, I did. I got the big salary.
The writers didn't get it. We never got paid for writing.
But we immediately canceled Judge Colombo's subscription to the Fifth Estate. And it was the first contribution to the Free John Sinclair Fund, which culminated. Tell us about this John Lennon and Yoko Ono in Ann Arbor in 1971.
Okay, well, you know, the thing that's really close to my heart is the 2.5 years before that, when everyone, starting with the Fifth Estate and the bands and the W radio stations and what have you.
WABX, yeah.
Okay, thanks. I can see.
We can say they're gone.
Because they're gone. They aren't competition anymore. But, I mean, everybody just tried so hard to get me out of prison for a long time. It wasn't like I never felt like I was abandoned or like I was, you know, I felt a tie, a palpable tie to the community that I was part of, even though I was in Marquette Prison the first year on the banks of Lake Superior, 600 miles from my wife and family. But I never felt isolated or that people weren't with me. And believe me, I probably would have killed myself if I wouldn't have had that, because they weren't going to let me out. You know, they say, how do you do that time? Well, you either do the time or you end your life right there, you know. So that didn't appeal to me too much. But, I mean, my spirits, and I was so nuts, you know, and I thought this was part of my job. I'm a revolutionary. It's time for me to go do my time. And everybody I'd read about, they all had to do time. So it wasn't a shock in that way. It was a shock not to get an appeal bond.
Yeah, that's
amazing. That was really out of the ordinary.
Right.
And then, I don't know if you remember this, but the really deep part was the Michigan Court of Appeals ruled that I was a danger to society and not to be granted a bond.
Well, that's a high compliment on one hand.
I felt good about it.
But on the other hand, it kept you in...
But they invoked a case involving... Vito Giacalone.
the mafia guy.
Yeah, who they found a blackjack in his drawer.
Yeah.
And I gave him 4.5 to 5 for carrying a concealed weapon. Okay, and he appealed. In his case, they established this criteria to determine whether someone was a threat to society. And he was deemed not to be.
Wow.
But applied against me. These criteria were upheld, and I was deemed to be a threat.
I was looking quickly.
That's some sick stuff.
It is. I was looking quickly through Guitar Army. Actually, the old edition is a brand new one out, Guitar Army by John Sinclair. An introduction by our pal Michael Simmons.
Yeah.
Subtitle, Rock and Revolution with MC5 and the White Panther Party. And it is published, what is this, Process Book? Is that?
They call it Process Media. When I signed, it was called Feral House.
You can go to johnsinclair.net.
Even down in the underground, they have all these corporate takeovers and shuffles.
Well, you know, you had a poem, logos, which I was looking through the original edition for, and I don't know, I don't think it's in here, but that where you catalog, you're sitting in your jail cell in Marquette or in Jackson, all the things you have to do, and all the things that are facing you, and the last line is 9.5, 10 years will never
be enough time. Yeah, that wasn't in a book. That was probably in the Fifth Estate.
That's right.
Boy, oh boy. You know, wherever I go, I introduce the concept to the people of today. So we used to have this wonderful thing called the underground press. So people everywhere, they had their own papers.
Well, what about the internet now? You have John Sinclair.
Well, that's different. I mean, that's good. But, I mean, the underground press.
It was, yeah.
That
yeah.
was a beautiful thing.
It was,
me.
Yeah. 500 weekly papers with a subscription weekly in the millions.
Yeah, and every paper had to send a copy to every other paper.
That's right.
I love that. You go to the office and there'd be papers from Vancouver and Austin, Texas, and places you didn't even know where they were. You could read about what they were doing there.
John Sinclair, you're as discursive as I am. We were.
You're running the show, so okay. I'm just here to
Night. You served 2.5 years in prison for possession of marijuana. 9.5 to 10 years was the sentence. And there's a big concert in Ann Arbor in 1971.
So December 10th.
Yeah.
Well, we organized this concert starting in the fall. I insisted that we create some kind of massive event to put pressure on the Michigan legislature to change the law.
The marijuana laws. Yeah.
The year before, they had gone right to the winter break, and they didn't bring it to a vote. So really, our initial purpose was to force them to vote on this Perry Bullard-sponsored act that would completely reschedule drugs and their penalties. Marijuana was called a narcotic. That was the main basis of my appeal, that it wasn't a narcotic. Anyway, so Peter Andrews, who was our friend and former manager of the SRC, he was working for the University of Michigan as a consultant to teach him how to do profitable rock and roll events in the campus facilities.
There you go.
After we used to have to sue them to get them to give us a facility for a dance. Then we organized this thing, and then we were terrified because we had this 14,400-seat arena, but we didn't have anybody comparable on our roster. We had our friends, like Archie Shepp, Phil Oakes, people of this nature, and political speakers, Commander Cody, the Up. But none of them were going to fill this thing. And then all of a sudden, John Lennon and Yoko Ono heard about it from Jerry Rubin. And they decided to come and play on this and help us out. And he wrote a song for me. And then in about a 4-day period, everything was completely transformed in my life from, you know, pulling my hair out in this prison cell in Jackson to looking forward to John Lennon coming to sing his song about me at Chrysler Arena. I was pretty geeked up.
Well, there were some fairly decent other opening acts as well.
Yeah, it was a great show.
I mean, Bob Seger.
Yeah.
And
well, you know, you could never get Bob to play Benefits. Punch would never want to play Benefits in those days. But this one got so big that he wanted to be on it.
Stevie Wonder?
Yeah. Stevie Wonder called up and asked if he could bring his band at his expense because he heard about this guy and he hated that.
Isn't that
deep?
It is. And I'm sure we're missing Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah, Bobby Seale.
Bobby Seale from the Black Panther Party.
Jerry Rubin.
So it was an enormous event.
Your MC, Bob Righteous Rudnick.
That's right. WABX DJ at the time. So everybody knows that we have these events for political prisoners and, you know, that we're. But usually it does nothing. But the most extraordinary thing happened.
Yeah, I got out 3 days later.
Oh, wow.
Well, it was all good plan. I mean, in retrospect, it was good planning. I mean, that's what I look at it because we made it look like a miracle, but really we had all the ducks in a row. On the night before the rally, the day before the rally, they passed the new drug laws. Once they said John Lennon was coming, man, everybody just started screaming to get the shit in order, you know. Well, we can't let John Lennon come here and see that this crazy injustice is going on. We got to make a change in this. That's what I thought. Because it just shook everything up. It just took it to a whole different level.
Of course,
it wasn't just people like you and me raising trouble like we always did. But the guy from the Beatles was coming here to see what was going on.
Well, he came on stage, 1, 2 in the morning?
No, 3, I think.
3 in the morning? And it was my wife and I were in the stands, not on the floor. I never did like crushes. And people rushed forward, and suddenly that stage started to sway a little. Yeah, in fact, I don't know whether it was Lennon or whoever, but they said, whoa, you know, get back.
And then Tom Verzad let off the string of firecrackers.
I was covering it for WABX, so I got.
I just saw the rushes, you know. I just saw the footage. You know.
Well, but John Lennon's participation in the Free John Sinclair rally also had a significant effect on him, didn't it? I mean, with the FBI.
Well, yeah, it turned into a bad thing. That's what I feel bad about. Well, getting this guy in trouble with the government.
Well, you know, he would have gotten in trouble anyway.
Well, maybe you're right.
Because there's a
maybe you're right.
Because this is
it's like the guy at the bar, we shouldn't have never gave him that last drink.
Well,
he ran into the tree.
In the film, what was it? United States versus John Lennon. Is that the proper
name? Yeah,
they there's footage of you leaving prison.
Yeah,
and it's just incredible when you meet you know, your wife at the time, Lenny.
Yeah, I met my baby daughter, Celia.
Celia was there, Sonny, and I remember I was watching him. I was fighting back tears, and I'm sure you weren't fighting them back at all.
No, it's a wonderful thing to see that. You know, I got my own movie coming out.
You do?
Year, in the fall. Where? Called 20 to Life.
Really?
The Life and Times of John Sinclair, film by Steve Gebhardt.
And I'm not in it? Never mind. I'm only kidding. I'm only kidding.
You're getting all the releases now. If you are, you'll hear from me.
All right. John Sinclair is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Brand new edition of Guitar Army, this time with the subtitle Rockin' Revolution with MC5 and the White Panther Party. It ought to be at most of your bookstores. Start with the indies first, the independent ones like BookBeat.
BookBeat has it for sure. Yeah.
JohnSinclair.net is where you can look at all of
them. Shame and Drone has it in Ann Arbor.
Well, we just got a little bit of time. So the book was first published in 1972.
Two.
Let's bring it up to 2007. You're so a lot of time, and so we're kind of reminiscing. And what's the impact of all this on younger people when they hear you and they see you? You perform a lot around the world.
Well, I'm a relic, you know. I'm a emissary from a time that doesn't exist anymore.
Do you think you're seen like that?
Well, you can't. To avoid seeing an old guy up there. That's me. I'm an old guy. You know, I know spring chicken. I could do cosmetic things, but I mean, when I get up there, they know I'm an old guy. I've been around for a while.
But you've got
it. Then when they hear me talk,
there you go.
They're exhilarated.
Well, that's what I mean.
To see that there's an old guy who still has these kind of ideas that to them are still a little far out. They know this guy's been having them for 40 or 50 years, so they really like me a lot. And I get a lot of love from the young people. And they always want to know what to do. And I say, well, do whatever you want to. I say, my preachment is to take the vow of poverty. If they take the vow of poverty, they can do whatever they want in art or whatever, because they aren't expecting to get paid for it. The people that turn me off are the ones that are trying to get their own TV show. You know, you meet some young poets, and they're real, what they want is their own TV show. Well, I don't even watch TV, you know, so I can't really relate to that.
Well, when we said music is revolution, and you're saying, well, I don't think that really panned out. In fact, the Fifth Estate...
Well, not in the sense I meant it.
No, in the Fifth Estate, one time we ran a full-page ad that showed these people in jail... And it was like for Columbia or something. They were essentially financing us, and it said, the man can't... bust our music.
Oh, yeah, Jim Ferrat designed that ad when he was on staff at Columbia Records.
But they did, in a lot of ways, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, they bought it.
Yeah.
First, they bought the papers off by buying the full-page ads and then withdrawing them, ruining the underground press. Isn't that what happened?
That almost sunk the Fifth Estate. Yeah. The Fifth Estate?
Well, the Fifth Estate's the only one still going.
That's interesting. Yeah,
they are not at all typical.
You go to fifthestate.org.
I remember The Sun, which I was involved in at that time, you know, and they pumped you, and you had all these ads, and then all of a sudden, they decided that they were gone too far or something. Well, they do the same things in-house. They decide these bands that aren't going to pay off, so they cut 50 of them, you know,
roster. 2 minutes left with John Sinclair. Tell us about the Blues Scholar and your work around the world. We see your blog. You're just traveling everywhere.
Yeah, I've kind of taken a pledge of travel in my old age. I never did it before, because I always had a lot of other things to do. And about 12 years ago or so, I decided I wanted to pursue my performing arts career before my life was over. I was 53 at that time. So usually you're 23 when you start that. So, but I work hard. I'm known as the hardest working poet in show business.
Well, and you play. You read some of your extraordinary poetry.
I read and recite. I don't have to read all of it now. Some of it I know by heart, so it's more fun.
And unfortunately, everything that you've done in the Detroit area has gone by. And I should say you were, of course, centered in Detroit for so long, but now hometown, Amsterdam, Holland?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amsterdam.
Yeah.
I like it there. Yeah. Well, nobody's armed, and they don't care if you get high. Those are the two biggest. And they aren't stupid. They haven't been dumbed down completely. You have conversations with your waiter that are better than conversations you have here with people who have graduated from college. Because they're so nuts here, you know. But they know who's going to win American Idol.
They do. Also, it's all done, what you said one time at a seminar, you said they just do everything here so they can play golf. Right?
Yeah. Well, really success is to fly to Acapulco for the weekend to play golf.
There you go. All right, the book is Guitar Army, Rock and Revolution with the MC5 and the White Panther Party, a brand-new edition of Guitar Army 35 years after its first appearance. And we forgot to mention, how could I do this, that there's also a CD.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, an 18-track CD, rare recordings of John reading poetry, music, tons of stuff.
So you're never going to hit singles from there.
There you go. John Sinclair, thanks for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, thanks for being here, man. You're a constant inspiration. You still have it.
WRIF.com.
more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. And you're listening to a rock and roll station, so do you expect to hear rock and roll, but what characterizes and distinguishes that form of music? Very frequently, it is the electric guitar. The electric guitar has been with us so long that even our grandparents will say, oh, yeah, I listened to Charlie Christian, who used to play with Benny Goodman. So it's like the piano or the trumpet or something like that. And just like those instruments have histories, so does the electric guitar. Joining me is Andre Millard. He's Director of American Studies and a Professor of History at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And he has edited a very, very interesting book. It's called The Electric Guitar, A History of an American Icon. So much so that the book is published in cooperation with the Smithsonian National Museum of American History and the Lemelson Center for the Study of Invention and Innovation. Boy, I'm out of breath, Andre Millard. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Peter.
Thanks for being here. It's published, by the way, by John Hopkins Press. Why would a prestigious university press, why would a distinguished professor of American Studies and History be interested in the lowly American electric guitar?
Well, because it's so important. I mean, it's the most important instrument of the 20th century. Will probably be the most important instrument of the 21st century. You can't really take the music out of American culture in the 20th century. And in terms of Johns Hopkins have a reputation for doing the most beautiful books about technology, you know, such as The Railroad Car. I mean, they make beautiful books where they treat the technology as an image, you know, as an artifact. And, you know, the guitar is such a, you know, beautiful artifact.
It is indeed. I mean, besides the sound that it makes, well, that's probably about 90% of the layman's appreciation, like mine. But then there is the object itself. But maybe we can do this, because it's pretty fascinating. Someone asked me, when did the electric guitar appear? I would say, you know, wasn't it the jazz guitarist Charlie Christian playing with Benny Goodman, but in the late 30s? But it goes back before that, doesn't it?
It does, but it was Charlie Christian who made the electric guitar, and that Gibson EH-150, you know, is a classic model guitar, and it has that really distinct sound. And I mean, it was Charlie Christian who took, in his own words, the guitarist from a robot just strumming to an artist, someone who's in the center. I mean, when you think about those Benny Goodman quartets and quintets, I mean, it's Charlie Christian's guitar that's the lead.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell people the previous role of the guitar. I don't think people...
Well, it's just been a basic rhythm instrument that was very soft, you know, in volume compared to the other instruments. And as bands grew bigger in the 20s and 30s, I mean, it was being basically overshadowed by saxophone, trumpet, you know, the horn sections that was developed. And it was just in the background, just strumming the rhythm. That was it.
You can hear it sometimes on Count Basie when the band's a little quiet. You can hear just his guitar. And what was it, Freddie Green? He had a famous rhythm guitarist. But yeah, up till then in jazz, it was accompaniment to other bass instruments like the stand-up bass and the tuba.
Well, the thing is, if you think just about Count Basie, I mean, whatever the guitarist, I mean, the bassist. I mean, you listen to the bass on Count Basie because, I mean, it's, I mean, that is the instrument to me that makes, I mean, Count Basie, best rhythm section ever in my mind. Mm-hmm. And it's the drummer and the bassist that you listen to. They're both superstars in the world of jazz. Because they're louder and it's more an expressive, you know, more an expressive instrument. But once you start electrifying the guitar, you get all these tonal possibilities.
How did people react when they first heard an electrified guitar? It must have been fairly a stunning reaction.
It wasn't in terms of jazz musicians. Certainly there was, you know, that it was accepted. You know, what was holding Charlie Christian back was his race, I think, more than his guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the wonderful story of his acceptance with Benny Goodman, you know, one of the most discriminating tastes in the world of music is a wonderful story. But, I mean, in terms of when the guitar started to upset people is when it got loud.
Mm-hmm.
And when it got into the hands of women, and maybe when it got in the hands of African American musicians and got into the mainstream of American popular music, that's when, you know, the sound was seen as a threatening sound. We have a little story in the book about a very little known female guitarist from the 30s. And, you know, she says that they didn't like her playing loud. I mean, they, you know, her name was Cordell Jackson, and she says, no man could touch what I was doing, she says. And they tried to take her guitar away from her or make her play quietly. You know, it's the volume of the electric guitar that gets to people.
Well, and the instrument is still seen as kind of predominantly a male instrument. We're sort of amazed when women play the guitar in the same style as men. I mean, during the 80s, I can't remember who was this woman. She used to a very, very attractive woman, and she played essentially in her underwear. You know, she was. Do you remember? You don't remember who that is? Someone. All these listeners.
That probably made a big impression on you, Peter, didn't it?
Yeah, not her playing exactly. I don't remember that as well. But it was. It is unusual to play the guitar in your underwear. I would.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
It could have been, you know, Joan Jett.
Not Joan Jett.
Or one of those.
Yeah.
They were basically, or Susie Quattro. Basically, they were beautiful women trying to act like men in leather outfits or in their underwear. But nowadays, you know, the gender distinction in the electric guitar, which you're perfectly right. I mean, they've significantly shifted in the 5 or 6 years, you know, that this book's been in preparation. I mean, now, in the advertisements for electric guitars, you know, you often see young girls playing as much as young boys, you know. I mean, in terms of the wrappings on the cover and the promotional material. So
that's where marketing will lead culture.
Or it'd be an indication of culture.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
ways.
It's just a measure of, you know, they're not stupid, and I'm not. I think, you know, they know who's buying their guitars, and they know who wants an electric guitar, and so now it's really no longer a boy's toy anymore. But 10 years ago, I mean, it's exactly, or maybe a little longer. I mean, it's changed very, very rapidly, and now you see lots of bands with all female guitarists. And really nobody raises an eyelid. But the thing is, they don't play in their underwear.
Yeah, that's good. That's an advancement as well. The book is The Electric Guitar, A History of an American Icon. And my guest on the Peter Werby Show is Andre Millard. He is the editor, has essays in there as well. And part of this book is about the technological development. So what did Charlie Christian do? Just take an old-fashioned guitar and slam a pickup on it?
No, he popularized Gibson's first big commercial attempt at having an electric guitar. And there were plenty of people who had put, you know, pickups on acoustic guitars and, you know, and amplified it. I mean, it's not that big a deal to amplify, but actually having, you know, the electrical pickup built into the guitar, and, you know, it was sold with an amplifier, which I think was less than 15 watts. And, you know, he was the great guitarist, he was a star, and he really popularized that instrument. I mean, at those days, you know, those were long ago, but I'm sure you remember him, Peter, you know, when jazz really was popular music.
I've read about it in the history books. and also that Benny Goodman, an incredible musician, an innovator, and also willing to overcome social convention at the time by integrating his band, which, of course, was not real popular at that time as well.
Oh, I know. I mean, and you've got to remember, back then, integration was rare or non-existent, and it was a very courageous move on his part because, you know, the division between the races was pretty strong, and especially in the entertainment field, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about some of these things that turn out to be innovations that are named after people. A lot of people have, I mean, I suppose if someone has a guitar and it's called a Les Paul, they understand that it's that's named after someone. Hopefully they know who it was. And things like the Fender, which I've had people think that, you know, it's named after, like, the part of the car or something like that. Could you talk a little, as we get up into the 40s and into the 50s, what sort of technology was developed by these men and what kind of impact it had on the music?
Well, Fender and Les Paul, you know, are kind of co-authors of the solid body electric guitar, which was, you know, the next logical step from putting a pickup on an acoustic.
Mm-hmm. So there's no sound box.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then you're working with a solid piece of wood. And both Les Paul and Leo Fender, remember, were heavily into electronics. They were both, you know, they're known as guitar makers, but, you know, Les Paul was the man who developed the multi-track recording system used in recording studios. Leo Fender was known for his amplifiers well before he made that first broadcaster guitar. So what they were doing was kind of working on a system. And, you know, all the tonal possibilities that you can get out of a guitar now, you can go any route you want. You can change the amplification. You know, you can get it. You can work on the entire system to get a tone, rather than just trying to alter the settings on the guitar itself, or just the way you play. You know, your left hand technique. So, when they were freed from that hollow body, then they could, you know, develop the electric guitar as a discrete instrument with its own, you know, tonal palettes.
Mm-hmm. You have these incredible photographs in your book, The Electric Guitar, as well. One of them is Les Paul, who I believe is still with us and still playing, isn't he?
He's still with us. He's still playing. Yeah. He plays the same place once a week in New York City.
That's right.
I understand he's in fine health, and, you know, if any of your listeners really want an experience, go and listen to him play, and then he just hangs out with the audience.
Yeah. And he's what, probably in his late 80s?
I bet he's even older than that.
Really?
I wouldn't surprise me. And, you know, but he still plays, and he's still, along with, you know, people like Chuck Berry in his 70s.
Hmm. And now, the photograph in your book shows he cut an acoustic guitar in half and put a solid strip he called the log. Explain that a little.
That, you know, there's all this different, I mean, the competition for who invented the solid body guitar is intense, and, you know, it's so important to the companies who are still competing and doing business that, you know, they'll sue one another if one of them claims, you know, to be the historical precedent for the guitar. So it's very sensitive and highly controversial. But Les Paul version of events is that he actually strung a pickup, which is really the important part, on that piece of wood, did you say, and then I think he was playing an Epiphone, and he took, you know, the two sides of the Epiphone, the hollow sides, and just glued it, I think, to that solid piece of wood. The important thing is that, you know, the amplification system could work with a block of wood. You didn't need, and as you say, you didn't need a sound box. People have put that pickup in bits of plastic and probably bits of cement or something like that. And that was a very important innovation. But as Les Paul says, no manufacturer was interested.
Hmm. Also, talk a little about the shape. The people have made the obvious observation that that the guitar, the classic guitar, the classical guitar, has the shape of a woman. And yet, did you ever notice it?
Well, there's a lot of people that.
Maybe I should talk to a therapist. Never mind.
You know,
this is the second time I've brought up women's bodies. Maybe I have a problem here.
I was
here.
Thinking, you know, is it going to turn out to be like the Howard Stern?
All right. I'm blushing a little, but let's get to the shape. But all of a sudden, the traditional shape of the guitar at the top on both the top and the bottom of it are sculpted out, and yet if the eye can form the shape of the traditional guitar, what's that all about?
Well, because it's an instrument like a violin, which also has the shape of a woman, and there has to be constructed primarily in view of its properties as an echo chamber, as an amplification.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's why you bend and shape that wood the way you do, and that's where the craftsmanship of the luthier comes in. You move to electric pickups, it doesn't matter what you put it on. I mean, that was the thing. It liberated guitar makers from one shape. They can make any shape they want. They could make any bass they want. I mean, it's, I mean, the wood is still important to the sound of guitar, but, the, you know, the world was now their oyster. And if you just look at colors, you know, I mean, guitars came in violin finish.
Right.
Sunburst violin finish. Not anymore. When Fender and Les Paul out, you could get them gold. You can get them white, which is very, very popular. You get them red. And back to your comment about, you know, Fender being thought of as part of the automotive industry. They're based in California, and there's a lot of companies around them that make paint for automobiles. They got a lot of their ideas for the paint finish for the electric guitar from, you know, those sparkle finishes and other glossy finishes developed by, you know, chemical companies that we won't name on the air.
Okay. I was just looking, because you have in your book, The Electric Guitar, that you edit, you have at least four essays. And just tell us about this one, Playing with Power, Technology, Modernity, and the Electric Guitar. We usually, like I said at the beginning, we take that sound for granted. But once one starts looking under the surface of anything, more appears. What's in here that you're looking at?
Well, the technology idea is the guitar as an example or a harbinger of modernity, of new technology. You know, it's developed. The solid body guitars start running, coming off the lines, you know, early 50s, 52, 54. At that point in time, you know, we're right after World War II. The United States is thinking of itself as the high-tech leader. And especially space travel, shape of the guitars, many of those guitars, you know, reflect space aerodynamic design, such as the Gibson Flying V.
I was just looking at that, yeah.
And so, you know, and the electrical guitar manufacturers, you know, position themselves as, you know, purveyors of very high technology and selling a very modern product. You know, they embrace, you know, as I write in the book, the American people were embracing space travel from, you know, NASA to the Jetsons. The electric guitar was just a wonderful example of this sort of design, but this sort of technology. And the playing of with power aspect was how the unlimited amount of power that you could get out of amplifiers changed the whole sound of music and the way you play the guitar.
Well, talk to us a little, because Andre Millard, you're Director of American Studies, Professor of History, about the image of the guitar itself, because in another era, we mentioned Benny Goodman in the 30s and the 40s, the clarinet, people like, besides Goodman, Artie Shaw, Buddy DeFranco, any number of people, band leaders, led with a clarinet.
Right, Sidney
Bechet. Definitely. And those, the clarinet has gone into almost total eclipse, and someone would think now, if someone hauled one out, you're going to be treated to polka music. So that there's these, you know, Benny Goodman at Carnegie Hall with his clarinet raised to the sky. For those young people in the late 30s, our grandparents probably, that was this cultural image of you know, excitement and great music. And then now it's the guitar and that characteristic pose we think of a guitar player. Yeah. So there's a big cultural shift in imagery.
Yeah, it's the iconography. But remember, between the clarinet and the guitar, there was a saxophone.
Right, right.
I mean, the image of the guy playing the saxophone was a very powerful image.
Yeah, Red Prysock, a lot of those.
Oh, well, you know, but I mean, Charlie Parker and Dexter Gordon and all those smoky 50s clubs.
Those weren't really mainstream culture in many ways.
Maybe not so, but yeah. I think, you know, when we get the first wave of rock and roll, you know, the lead instrument's the saxophone.
That's right. Yeah, in fact, I began playing the clarinet when I was a kid, and my father had great visions of me playing classical clarinet, and I wanted a saxophone, and he wouldn't buy it for me, so I quit. I just quit. Clarinet? What the hell, you know?
That's a hard instrument to master, though.
What, the clarinet? Well, yeah.
I mean, the saxophone's not easy either. No. The difference is the guitar is a very easy instrument to master.
Is it? Why? I mean, I've kind of picked it up once in a while. But
well, it's simple. You don't have to, you know, you can fret, you can make, You imagine the difference between trying to blow through a reed to reach a certain tone.
That's right.
And just getting your finger on the fret cleanly.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing is that you've got the whole, you know, all the scales at, literally at your fingertips on the fretboard.
Hey, let's. We were talking about gender, and we did mention about a little about race in terms of Charlie Christian, one of the innovators of jazz guitar. Is there does the guitar have a racial?
Most definitely. It's an instrument of power. It's an instrument of sexuality. The people who created the sound that we associate with the electric guitar were all African American. It most certainly does. You know, that was one of the things why rock and roll was so frightening to the establishment in the 50s. It was an empowerment movement and a movement that embraced diversity.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think now, though, that the guitar is seen as an instrument of white rock and roll culture? Most African American music now is kind of doesn't employ them that frequently.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it depends what generation you're in.
Yeah,
our generation always sees it that way. Because, you know, we remember the great players, you know, Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker, Albert King and all those. So maybe this coming generation doesn't see it that way. But, I mean, for every Eric Clapton, you've got an Albert King. I mean, in fact, Eric Clapton is kind of another Albert King in a way. I think where African Americans did not take the guitar was in heavy metal, which is now, you know, probably, in terms of radio, one of the most popular expressions of guitar music.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
I was kind of sorting through that because there is such diversity of music, and it's all so niche now that kind of making a general statement is difficult. I mean, yeah. I don't disagree with what you're saying. You know, we only have about a couple of minutes left, and I don't think much has been done with the violin in the last 300 years. Does the guitar have anywhere to go?
It does. You think of all the challenges it's weathered. It challenged the synthesizer challenge of the 70s and 80s. The sampler challenge of the 90s, I mean, it's kept pace with every technological development in music. And it's kept pace with every aesthetic, you know, every the way that popular music has developed. So, you know, hip-hop, for example, which you might on first glance think is devoid of electric guitars, is actually full of electric guitars. You can't get away from that electric bass.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And, you know, the people who sample electric guitars. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a very durable technology. And, you know, the number of guitars sold goes up every year. More and more people are playing them. So I really don't see any decline. I mean, I see a decline in certain styles of guitar, such as I think we've seen the end of jazz guitar, regretfully.
Really?
Well, I mean, you just don't hear it, do you?
Well, you don't hear a lot of jazz on the radio. Anyways, I just bought a new LP cabinet for all my LPs, and suddenly we started going through all my old jazz LPs. I'm going, oh, my God. When they finally put me under house arrest, I'll be pleased to stay there, listen to my LPs, and read my books. The market giveth, the market taketh away. No, just one last quick question. We only have about 60 seconds.
Okay.
There's not a lot of instruments that come along. I mean, I'm thinking of the saxophone in the, what was it, like the late 19th century and the electric guitar. And it's kind of hard. I mean, how can one predict? I mean, what possible other instruments? There was like, what, the theremin that, you know.
Yeah, that was an interesting instrument.
But anything, could you imagine, and this maybe is asking you for too much, I can't, can you, what, a new instrument?
Oh, there'll be a new electronic instrument, definitely. It'll be one of these multi-function sampler synthesizers. I mean, I don't think we're going to make any new sounds, but I think we are going to make the old sounds in different ways.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. My guest has been Andre Millard, and he is the editor and has several essays in the book, The Electric Guitar, A History of an American Icon. It's published by John Hopkins University Press, and Andre Millard is the director of American Studies and a professor of history at the University of Alabama. We in Birmingham, we could tell that by your southern accent.
This is true.
That's right. The book is filled with great photographs, many in color, and it's everything from a history to contemporary reflections on what makes up our music. Thank you, Andre Millard.
Thank you, Peter, for having me.
Listing WRIF.com.
Into love, the God. Into fear, the flame. Into burn, the crowd.